Committee will come to order. It's 5:34. The clerk will note the roll. I don't believe we have a quorum yet. We're halfway there. We are going to lay over most of the bills today, but we do want to have the committee get informed. We're going to be marking up our omnibus bill here this week, and we want to get as many bills before us as possible so we can at least know somewhat what we're doing. The chair will move House Bill 3635 for possible inclusion in the omnibus state government finance bill. Representative Broad was not available to come today, but Representative Simon was kind enough to come in as a co-author and present the bill. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. I'm here as the second-string quarterback today because Representative Broad couldn't be here. House Bill 3635 would simply enable the Campaign Finance Board to hire, at its discretion, a part-time attorney. This went through civil law and elections without any opposition that I know of, and there was a demonstrated need at the time. I don't know if anyone here is from the Campaign Finance Board. Yes. Okay. Great. I think they could speak to the actual need.
Ms. Olson?
Better than I could.
Welcome to the committee. I'm just trying to find the bill here. Here it is. Broad and Simon, 3635. Okay, very easy bill. Could you just give a brief explanation of how this will work, and does it have a little fiscal impact, or what's the situation?
Mr. Chair, Jean Olson, Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Thank you for hearing this bill this evening. It does not have a fiscal impact if the bill passes. The board intends to hire a part-time legal, part-time staff attorney to advise the staff and board on an as-needed basis. There have been some times in the past year where there's been a conflict when the attorney signed to the board by the Attorney General's office couldn't represent the board, and board's concerned about the 2006 election with the complicated issues and the increased number of requests for advisory opinion.
Okay, and is this going to supplant another staff person, or... No, the fiscal impact makes me wonder, how are you going to be able to have an attorney? I'm assuming it's going to cost probably $100,000 or something.
Oh, Mr. Chair, we don't think it'll cost that much because it's only going to be on a part-time as-needed basis.
Okay.
And we will do some rearranging of current staff.
So it'll be similar to a city attorney for a small to mid-sized town where they'll have person available as needed.
That's correct, Mr. Chair, and someone familiar with our issues.
Could Representative Mullery be one of the attorneys, or is that a conflict of interest?
Mr. Chair, that would be a conflict of interest, although okay. He'd be a very good attorney.
Really? Okay. Very good. Any members of the committee have a question? Representative Hilty, you heard this already, didn't you, in Elections Committee?
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Campaign Finance can hire or have an attorney on staff?
Yes.
Okay. Very good. Any other questions on the bill? Very good. We will lay that bill over. And thank you for coming in. We appreciate it. Representative Wardlow, the chair will move for consideration House Bill 3243, protections for persons ordered into active military service. Representative Wardlow, we've heard this in another committee. Did you say this passed the floor already as well?
Yes, Mr. Chair, 133-0.
Okay. And just give us a brief explanation of what this is, Representative Wardlow.
Well, what it does, there's two federal laws that concern veterans who are ordered to federal active duty service. One is the Service Members Civil Relief Act, I'll call it the SCRA law, and the other one is the Uniformed Service Members Employment and Reemployment Rights Act, which both of these laws are concerned with federal active duty. And after 9/11, back in 2002, the SCRA law was changed in state law so that the same protections that federal active duty members had are given to people that are called active duty within the state. Because after 9/11, a lot of National Guardsmen and reservists were called to active duty for 180 days to a year or more. And so up until then, it was never a problem. But now, whatever rights they get if they're active duty federally, they're afforded the same rights statewide. And that was done for the SCRA law. This law, the SCRA law, used to be this Soldiers and Sailors Civil Rights Act. And when we changed the law back in 2002 to let it apply to state law, the name also had been changed to SCRA instead of SFCRA, and we forgot to change that in our law, so it's just a housekeeping bill. But the USARA law, that's what we're trying to do now, is allow that the same rights for employment when they return from active duty federally are given to those who are called active duty in the Minnesota state within the state.
Hey, Representative Wardlow, do you know if this has passed the Senate or what the status might be over there?
I know it passed one committee, but I don't know where. I know that Senator Gerlach is carrying it.
Okay.
And I think it passed his committee, but I'm not sure. I don't know where it is after that.
The administrator said that it's passed to the floor, but I think just to be safe, we'll put it in the omnibus bill just to make sure. So we'll move it for possible and very likely inclusion in the omnibus bill. Any questions? Very good. Thank you, Representative Wardlow. Next bill would be Representative Severson. You look like you're ready to go. House file, Chair will move House File 3072 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got one amendment on there. H 3072A1. And currently there's a Senate file is moving through the Senate, and this helps put it in the form that the Senate will be passing theirs in.
And this is the basic statement in favor of our military veterans, and that's all one sentence. Is that right?
Grammatically correct. That's correct, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, I've got one amendment on there, the H3072A1 amendment. I wonder if we could move that to get it in the...
That has been handed out, members. The Chair will move the A1 amendment. Representative Severson, give us a brief explanation of this.
The portion of statute that deals with military and veteran affairs is the 190 series of the statute. And basically what this statement is doing is establishing a policy and purpose statement for the following provisions of law that recognize the sacrifices and some of the hardships that our military and veterans have encountered, and the formulation of the policies, and it's because of this that they are in a I won't say special category, but a unique category in which we have moved to try and create some provisions for our veterans and military people that typically aren't afforded to the greater number of people.
Okay, does anyone have questions on the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed nay. The amendment's adopted. Any questions or concerns on the bill? Seeing none, those in favor say, well, we aren't going to pass it. This is passed to the floor already, Representative Severson, right? Says that it was
second
reading, so we will put it in the, I think we'll likely put this in the omnibus bill just to make sure in case it gets hung up in the Senate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Next bill would be Representative Seibert. Looks like you're sitting there ready to go.
Yes, sir.
And the Chair will move for consideration House Bill 3664, National Guard Security Guards authorized to carry certain machine guns and short-barreled shotguns. Okay.
Huh?
Okay.
Really a good idea.
Everybody just woke up. Okay. Representative Seibert, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is my favorite subject, machine guns and short-barreled shotguns. This expands the list of eligible people to carry these weapons that are employed by the National Guard as security guards. These people go through background checks just like any federal employee that carries a machine gun, and also rigorous training just like the Guard does. These are the same weapons that are active duty and reservists carry, and basically these guys are employed. Many of them are in the Guard themselves, and they're employed by the state to work on a full-time basis as security guards for the bases. Previous law, they were left out inadvertently, and this is just basically to clean up and let them carry these weapons. And this is just for base security.
Questions on this bill? And this has had its second reading on the floor, and Representative Severson, is the Senate moving this, do you know?
That'd be Seibert, and yes.
Yeah, Seibert, Severson bill, it says second reading, but the Senate file, is the Senate moving this, do you know? Or?
Yes, I believe so.
They are. Okay, well, I think we'll consider this for the omnibus bill. It looks like it's non-controversial as much as the title looks like it might have some interest from people. But any members feel uncomfortable with this? Or
only with the title. I mean, is this really all right?
It looks fine to me. Is this, can they carry their machine guns home, or do they have to stay on base with it?
No. Basically, what happens is that the military regulations apply. And when they go to their posts, they go to the armory first, draw their weapon, go out to post. Okay. Then they, before they go home, they go back to the armory and turn the weapons in, so they don't bring any of these weapons home.
Okay. Well, Chairman, you know, one of the problems as we have these looser gun laws around is that the guns that get misused are the ones that are stolen. They're not people who have all the permits and that kind of thing doing it. So, but they would not be carrying guns in a place where it would be likely that they would be left in their car and stolen and so forth.
Mr. Chair, President of Con, no. Speaking from personal experience, I did this 50 years as a military policeman, and it is very controlled. If you're missing one round of ammunition, you're under investigation.
Okay.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Seibert, am I reading this correctly, that we're employing private security guards to guard a military base? Is that what we're doing here? Is this privatization of Camp Ripley?
Representative Seibert?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, no, that is incorrect. These are state employees.
Okay. Mr. Chair, how do we know that?
Is that page 2, lines 2.13 to 2.18, where it defines peace officer, Representative Seibert?
Well, Mr. Chair, 2.19 through 2.20 says any person who is paid a fee, wage, or salary to perform these functions.
Mr. Cleary, could you help us out with that one?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have to say I don't know the situation within Minnesota, but I know that throughout the military, they are privatizing lots of functions that were formerly done by soldiers in order to free up soldiers for fighting. Cooks, for example, security guards at most major military bases are all civilian security outfits. But I don't know about the specific situation in Minnesota.
Any other questions on the bill?
Well, Mr. Chair, I happen to know some people that work as security guards, including my youngest son, and I sure hate to think that we were authorizing him to carry a sawed-off shotgun around, which actually is what this seems to be doing.
Yeah.
I'd like some assurance that that's not what this is doing.
What does your son do? He's a security guard or a cook, or what does he do there?
he's a security guard.
At a National Guard base?
No. It's in for a private.
Okay. Representative Seibert, do you know?
Security guard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pope, it's my understanding these are state employees. They don't work for a private security company.
But military affairs, do you want to come down just to give assurances? I don't want to be on the floor with an omnibus bill and have a two-hour discussion about machine guns. So,
in order to carry these weapons, they do have to do the qualification, same as the military does.
Right.
Go through the same background check. Mr. Palmer, sir.
Good evening, Mr. Palmer.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. These are state employees that are trained to the same standards as their federal counterparts are. We provide security to the two air bases in Camp Ripley under cooperative agreements with the federal government. And they really control the training and the access to the weapons for these people.
How's that, Representative Mallory?
Mr. Chairman, a question. How does it limit, so that we know that that's going to be the same in the future? How does the language
Mr. Palmer, is there assurances that that's the situation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulery, the only way these people could get employed is if we agreed to do that. So we would ultimately maintain control in any case. If whatever the security arrangements were, the department would have control over that. In this case, they are state employees and would continue to be so. There's that's the way the agreements work with the federal government.
Mr. Chairman, before it ends up in the final bill, could we have assurance in the language?
Mr. Cleary?
Somebody can work that out.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Cleary.
Chairman, Representative Mulry, I think we may already have in Section 2. Section 2 refers to security guard employed by the Minnesota National Guard. I believe if you go down to line 219, for example, a security guard in person paid a wage or fee is defined. I believe that as one threads through the logic here, it would apply only to state employees employed by the National Guard. And that's essentially the way the Adjutant General testified as well at an earlier hearing.
Okay. We can work that out. Okay, any further discussion on this one?
No.
Okay. Bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Seibert. Mr. Palmer, appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative De La Forest, since you're the next person I see that's here, why don't we skip down to 3114. Chair will move 3114 for consideration for the omnibus bill. And come on up and explain your bill.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you. House File 3114 is a regular occurrence. It is the contract ratification bill. And I think that primarily I have Mr. Kubinger here with me to answer specific questions, but a lot of times what committee members want to know is there anything controversial in here? While that term is in the eye of the beholder, I can tell you that every item in House File 3114 was unanimously passed on a bicameral, bipartisan basis by the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. More than that, I'm proud to say I do not have pride of authorship of this bill. This bill is co-authored by all House members of the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, DFL, and Republican alike. And so in the interest of time, Mr. Chairman, I know that there are a number of bills to be heard tonight. Mr. Hubinger and I would be happy to entertain questions with respect to the bill or walk through the bill if that's your desire, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions? Representative Solberg?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just curious. Usually this bill is one that travels by itself.
Actually, it usually doesn't. But
what's the Senate doing?
Mr. Hubinger, what's the situation?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission Subcommittee on Employee Relations. I'm not sure if a formal decision has been made, but the bill is being heard in the full Finance Committee in the Senate tomorrow, and one possibility is for it to be included in the omnibus bill there as well.
That's right. And Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, I have not heard definitively either from Senator Scheid, who is the lead senator from the subcommittee. So, again, I'm not sure either exactly where it's going in the Senate.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I ask the question because one thing we do not want to do is to have this gets mixed up in the controversial things that may be included. And I would hope that you would at least consider sending this through as a separate one in addition to, so that if by chance in the negotiations something happens,
it gets messy,
we should have it available. And the reason for that is...
That's exactly what I was going to say, was to send it both ways.
Like dual tracking.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. And, you know, if we don't do this...
our full intention is to do it, no doubt about it.
And I think we just save some...
Well, it has to go to... Yeah, right. It'd have to go there, but...
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would encourage you to do both.
Okay. Any other discussion on it? So, should we... We could crank it up. Should we bring it up another time? And
no.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you can do it now.
Just move it out now to Ways and Means and also keep it for...
Okay.
No, you don't have to have the bill in front of you to put it in your omnibus.
Right. No, I know. I know that. You taught me that a long time ago.
You don't have to have anything in front of you.
No, I totally understand that. We are going to meet at least three or four times. Why don't we'll post it back in the agenda, and I just need to talk to Representative Knobloch about that. Is that unfair?
Sure.
Okay. Very good.
Yeah, Mr. Well, Chairman and Representative Stolberg, Representative Kahn, you make a good point. There's certainly no intention to play games with the contract ratification bill at all. So I agree with your point, Representative Stolberg and Mr. Chairman. There certainly is no issue with dual tracking this bill.
Sure. And we can post it as early as tomorrow if we want. I just need to track non-block down. So we will lay it over for almost guaranteed inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you. The next one would be Representative Hilty has House File 30, what was it?
33.
Representative Hilty. We're moving a little quicker than what members are used to, so we're scurrying around trying to find members that are in the building. Yeah,
3833?
Yes, it should be one of the last ones in the packet. I believe that's the number. Is that right, Representative Hilty? 3833?
Yes, that's
very good.
Sure.
You could explain that for us?
Mr. Chair, members, what this bill does is modify the provisions for the post-election review and audit that was put into the, I believe it was in the omnibus bill at the end of last session. No, actually, it was 2 years ago that we passed this bill. It, as things stand in statute right now, there's a provision for a post-election audit that would be of 80 precincts across the state, randomly selected 10 in each congressional district. It was pointed out to be both by the Secretary of State's office from one perspective and from county elections officials from another perspective that the provisions that we have currently in statute are somewhat troublesome, both in terms of the recount, which bill stands, or as state law stands currently, would provide for a recount of possibly up to 10 separate races, depending on what the particular circumstances were. And also the triggering mechanism could result in a statewide audit, perhaps sooner than would be prudent to do one. If we did have a statewide audit, it would be quite expensive, which was the perspective of the Secretary of State. And the elections officials pointed out that the way the recount works, they would be counting through the same stack of ballots perhaps up to 10 times. So what we propose to do, and in consultation with both the Secretary of State and county officials, worked out a compromise which limits the number of races to be audited to either only two or three. That would be president or governor in alternate election cycles, the U.S. Senate if that race is on the ballot, which would be two out of three elections, and the eight congressional district races. So that cuts down the number that would need to be audited, and at the suggestion of county officials, we changed the provisions for how the audit would be done in the bill as it currently exists. We would be requiring two precincts in each county of the state to be audited. In counties with between 50 and 100,000 registered voters, three precincts, and in counties with more than 100,000 voters, four. This does expand the scope of the audit somewhat, but it also assures, it gives certainty. Whereas before we might have counties being selected and being unprepared to do the audit, this way they know they're going to do it, and I think the colonies have recognized and expressed to me that actually they want to do this in order to demonstrate that, in fact, the systems that we're using are reliable and are producing accurate counts. So that's basically the bill, Mr. Chair.
Did the Secretary's office want to comment at all on the bill? Are you in support of it? And okay, I see it. We'll just have you come up and say a quick word on the record so we know we've got that. Welcome.
Chairman Seifert, members, thank you so much. I'm Jim Hansen, Intergovernmental Relations Director for the Office of the Secretary of State, and we are in support of Representative Hilty's bill. Feel that it is a good compromise to give quality assurances to the citizens and to the legislature that the elections are being held properly, and we're in full support.
Very good. Anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against the bill? Okay, very good. We will. Was this a dual track, or I don't
know. Mr. Chair, I think it would be prudent to do that because
the only issue, Representative Hilty, is we have that pesky little appropriation there that I'm not sure if we delete that or. It's kind of we usually
Mr.
don't send
Chair,
out blanks.
I have a preliminary note from the Secretary's office that indicates a cost of $33,000 per year. I think there's some question about that, and that the bill does not actually require them to do anything at this point.
Okay. So do we want to delete that piece, or?
I would just move to delete the appropriation section of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilty moves to delete page 4, lines 4.25 to 4.27. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Solberg,
that's the appropriation. I think that's a good move. But I thought in my discussion with Representative Hilty and others on this that we would be actually saving the Secretary of State's money by not doing as much.
Representative Hilty?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's
firing.
The Secretary's office, Noah, does this actually save you a little money by, you know, cutting down on the number of?
Yes.
Okay. He said yes for the record, so I think it would be wise to probably.
Chairman, that seems kind of strange. I said yes, we're saving money, but then we get a fiscal note that's going to cost $33,000, and they need a half-time person to do it.
Maybe we'll have them come back to the state. Are you comfortable taking the appropriation out and making this work? Welcome again.
Jim Hansen from the Secretary of State's office. The appropriation there, if we were previously appropriated money to do it the old way, then it is going to be a decrease in the amount of money that we were going to need in order to do the count. The $33,000, I think, is the appropriation that would be needed in order to do it in the current system versus what it was in the past. So,
Mr. Chairman, if we had got Holman not met, they would have been required to find some money someplace. That would have been how much money would have been required for you to find? How much in the old way would you have had to spend?
I'm sorry, Representative Solberg, I'm not sure I would have to go and find my fiscal people to get that answer for you.
Don't, because it costs more money.
Right.
Let's just take the appropriation out and
Mr. Hansen, it looks like there's kind of a consensus not to do the appropriation. Would you like the language without the appropriation? Or?
Yeah, we'll take the language without the appropriation. And
very good.
That's going to be, right?
That's the way it sounds here.
Yeah.
Okay, any other discussion? On the Hilty Amendment, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Okay, the amendment's adopted. Any other discussion? Representative Hilty is actually going to move that House Bill 3833 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register now that we have the appropriation out. This has been agreed to. I believe the county folks are okay with this. Are they in the room? Okay, I see a nodding of the head. Okay, so the Secretary, the county, the townships I see are here. They're okay, they're fine. All right, very good. Representative Hilty moves that House File 3833 be recommended and passed, be referred to the General Register. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Okay, that bill passes, and then also we will lay it over for the language over for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay.
Representative Sikora came in, I think. There she is. The chair will move that House File 2890 be recommended to pass and be referred to Ways and Means. Representative Sikora, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate you hearing the bill today, and I think a number of your members have already heard this bill in a couple of other committees. So, very briefly, what this bill does is create staggered terms for the Senate and four-year terms staggered for the House as well. So, in 1 year, all the senators from odd-number districts would run, and at the same time, the representatives from the even-number districts would be elected, so that there was always somebody running for office. Does that make sense?
Okay. Did you have one more thing?
It's written there. Take a look at it, Representative, but it is on there. But here's how I got to this. I think it's a pretty straightforward bill. And I'm somewhat of an idealist when it comes to political issues. And I've always felt it was important that you have people that you can throw out in 2 years. But that's why the U.S. House and the Minnesota House, et cetera, were always elected for two-year terms. But I think in this situation, you keep the opportunity for two-year terms. There would always be a group of people up for election or re-election so that the public would have a chance to illustrate their displeasure, so to speak, if that's the way they felt, or their pleasure by re-electing those folks all over again. You know, as I look around my district, I am about the only person I know who runs every 2 years. You know, the city council people all run for four-year terms. The school boards run for four-year terms. The mayors run for four-year terms. And, of course, the state senators run for four-year terms. And so as I go around, people always say, well, you're not up again. What are you coming around this year for? I say, oh, no, I'm up every election. We are up every single election, so it is my turn to be reelected, and so I'm back to ask for your support one more time. But so voters would still have their chance to do what they wanted to do by throwing half of us out each time if they wanted to. The advantages, I think, are we've seen what happens here in the last few years, and we've had so much more focus on politics than on policy. And for me, personally, I think we are here to try and do good policy for all the people in the state, not to try and create the best situation for our own party, for example. So all of us have had certainly some part in all of this, but if we were focused on policy and only half of us were up each election, I think there would be a much greater likelihood that we would be more focused on policy and that we would probably also have make sure that we were always keeping some people here who would keep this place stable. There'd be some leadership always who would not be up for re-election so that we would have, going forward, good people in place and the possibility for some good people to be unelected as there always is. So I think that's enough for that. I also think as you talk to people about running for office, more and more people say, I wouldn't have your job for anything. You have to run for office every 2 years. Everybody's always mad at you. You don't have a life, et cetera, et cetera. I think this would make things maybe a little bit better for some folks. So it's already, by the way, been amended because I was going to change the size of the bodies at the same every time we had a new census. At the next election, I was going to try and reduce the size of the legislature a little bit, but that got deleted in the first committee. Probably by Representative Kahn, I'm not sure.
No, it was me, actually. Representative Solberg.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm glad you deleted that because I want you to explain how Senate District 3 is. Senate District 3 starts in the middle of Mille Lacs Lake and goes up and includes the northwest angle. So if you reduce representatives, becomes that one is 300 miles long. That Senate district. So I'm glad you at least had the foresight to take that out since you probably can walk your district in a day. The other thing is, No, and that is, this works for the first time too, but then after the next election, the odd number district will always have a 2-year term after, and the evens in the Senate. And the evens a 4-year term as this goes
well, forward. No, you get to the end of the term. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. You know, just like now, senators have to run every 4 years, and then they have 1 2-year term. The House would be the same way. There would be 1 2-year term for them, and it would probably be right after redistricting, and then there would be 4-year terms for the House members at that point. So the senators, the half of the senators that were up first, would get
2-4-4 and
right.
Ones would go 4-4-2.
Yes. Sure. I mean, I think that's a little detail that would be pretty easy to work out.
Have you always had District 3 represent Solberg?
I've always had District 3B. 3B. Can you imagine that?
It looks like you're in good shape here. Representative Kahn.
All right. Mr. Chairman, I still don't quite understand how this works for each census. It seems we have, I understand, you have the census, so everyone runs for 2 terms, for 2 years. Then, at the next election after that, the senators from the odd-numbered, but you see, what seems unfair about it is that in each time you have a census, the short terms still go to the senators from the odd number districts and the representatives from the even number districts.
But
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn, after by the third time they run, they would be running for 2 more 4-year terms after their first term being elected as a 2-year term. And the people that end up that are in there for 4 years would be elected for a 2-year term at toward the end. Just as they are now, the Senate, that we always have had to run every 2 years, but the Senate gets 1 2-year term out of their 10-year census cycle.
Well, what I don't still don't understand what happens at the first election after that. After the new
okay, everybody always runs right after redistricting.
Everybody on the ballot in 2012.
Right.
Right.
And half will be running for 2-year terms and half will be running.
But they're always right. The same half. So everyone.
Representative Colbert,
that was my question, years. But it goes, yeah. Both the House would be, half the Senate would go 2-4-4, and then the other half would go 4-4-2.
In both bodies.
In both bodies.
Right.
That's what I was the same.
What number is your district, Representative Kahn? Have you always been 59?
No, I've gone from 57 to 58 to 59.
So what you want to do in this is make sure that the courts or somebody changes your number all the time.
If you're in for, how many cycles of redistricting have you been in for, Representative Kahn? 3 cycles, okay. You have to tell your quick redistricting story in the 1981 redistricting.
Well,
before they had technology and the computers.
Yeah, that was the one when all the maps appeared in the back.
Helpful.
And some poor person, I have no idea who it was, had a bill up at that time, and suddenly the floor has just vacated. They've all gone to that back alcove to look at the maps. And I'm looking at the maps, and right next to me is my co-representative at that time, Representative Larry Pogamilla. And I take one look at the two dots in the same box, and I turn to him and say, let me be the first person to urge you to run for the Senate. I mean,
well,
it was.
Fault that
yeah, right.
But,
it was, it was kind of like his house put into my district, but I knew he would work a lot harder, so I just like it anyway.
And he ran against the DFL incumbent for the Senate, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Any other questions on the bill? Representative Mulry.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sikora, I'm trying to figure this out, but wouldn't this mean that, the Senate would be... Would the Senate be running?
Do you have any handouts like math class?
No, but I can see I should have, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I'm just wondering if this opens up a chance for representatives to run against senators.
Mm-hmm. Sure, why not?
Yes, it does.
So that, that's what I thought it did.
Also, senators can run against representatives.
Yeah, they often do that, don't they?
They might.
Mr. Chairman, and also, I mean, realistically, I think it's a good idea to get four-year terms for the House. I think the things you talked about, and people do wonder why we're always running. But wouldn't it be...
Especially my wife.
Wouldn't it be more... make more sense to put in a bill and try to send it over that would have at least a chance of getting one vote in the Senate? And second of all, you said that you like the staggering. I think by doing the staggering, you're also... I mean, we know that... anybody that's been here a couple of weeks knows the games that are played, and everybody would be trying to get the people on votes that are up that year in this body and protect, and the other wouldn't be. So
that would be very difficult, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I'm not so sure that... I think that there's people that could figure that out. I think one's a chair.
Mr. Chairman, I think he just made the point why we need this bill.
Well, for everybody who's confused why we have two-year terms, the Founding Fathers felt that if you're mad at the government, you should be able to get rid of somebody, and that's why we have two-year terms for U.S. House, which we're modeled after, that... You know, some people like to have 10-year terms, I'm sure, and not never run for re-election. But that was the idea for everybody confused about that. All right.
But Mr. Chairman, with regard to that, we used to have 2-year terms in this state for governor. Almost everything, governor, local offices. You know, dog catchers were 2-year terms, and now we've gone to 4 years for everything in the state.
Not us. Okay. Anybody else have a question, concern, comment, etc. for the bill?
Just one question. Is there a House office or a Senate office?
What's the status in the
yes,
Senate?
Yes, there is. And you know, I forgot to check on that. But there is definitely a Senate author. And she said there was going to be a hearing. But I talked to her like 2 weeks ago. And I forgot to check up on what was happening there because it's been so crazy here. I just didn't get around to doing that.
Can you share with us the Senate author?
I think it's Senator Olson.
Okay. Any other discussion? The motion is that House Bill 2890 be recommended to pass and be referred to Ways and Means. Anybody want to testify for or against this bill? Okay. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed nay?
No.
Okay. The motion passes. Congratulations, Representative Cora.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The next, I thought I saw Representative Bisgins was in here.
He's
but
over
maybe.
There.
There he is. Okay. Okay, we'll move House Bill 587 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Bisgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, if it would serve your pleasure, I'd like to ask that the chair move an author's oral amendment.
Go ahead.
That would be to delete Section 3.
Okay, the chair will move... we don't have possession of the bill. Okay. But this is what you'd like if it would go on the omnibus bill. Be then. Okay. Let's pretend. Okay, so let's just pretend Section 3 is gone. Okay?
All right.
Very
Mr.
good.
Chairman,
Mr. Chairman, where is the bill?
The bill is on the House floor and read for the second time, but we had some of the elections bills brought before. Some we have formal possession of, like Representative Socorro's, and some we do not. But for the omnibus bill, we want to have hearings on these because they aren't going anywhere in the Senate or they're going to get hung up or what have you. So we want to know when we mark up the omnibus bill, let's try to at least have these before us so we all know what we're doing. I think Representative Hilty and De La Forest are the only two that are on the committee on elections. So the rest of us kind of at least need to know a little bit about these bills. Representative Hilty?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to clarify. I presume the version of the bill that we do have in front of us is the bill. So are we talking about Section 3 of Article 2, Representative Biskin?
Mm-hmm. Representative Biskin, what page are you on for Section 3? Page 4?
Mr. Chairman, that'd be page 4, lines 3 through 17.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, Representative Biskins, go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and I'll speak to that just very, very quickly. This section of the bill gives the townships a lot of heartburn, especially in very small townships that they might have to play pinochle a whole lot longer than they'd want to, all right, and that with a small population, they could finish the voting well before the, 8 p.m., so they wanted added flexibility. The reading this section would give towns added flexibility. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this bill is all about enfranchising the voters of the state of Minnesota. This bill is all about creating habits of voting within the state of Minnesota. This bill is all about maximizing voter turnout for any election that occurs within the state of Minnesota. This bill is a Uniform Periodic Elections Act. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it sets aside 5 days throughout the year where elections outside of special elections called by the governor, 5 dates where elections could be held. Those dates are the fourth Tuesday in January, second Tuesday in March, the third Tuesday in May, the first Tuesday after the second Monday in September, and the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. And if members caught that, three of those dates correspond to current voting dates, township elections, annual meetings, primary election date, and general election date. So there are two other dates in there for spacing, to help school districts, to help cities, to help port authorities, all right, in moving forward a referendum which may be necessary for the good and well-being of a local unit of government. Mr. Chair, that's all I have to add. I have with me Mr. Jim Hansen from the Secretary of State's office to say a few words.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Jim Hansen, Intergovernmental Relations Director of the Office of the Secretary of State again. This bill is important to election administration, but it's really more important to the voters. We've had constant complaints from citizens throughout the state that are confused about when their elections might be, only because an election would be held in a nearby township or a nearby school district, and they're seeing notice in a newspaper and they get confused with the notice that they have in an election. So there is some confusion that's created there. I'm a former mayor in another state, and in that other state we had restrictions on 5 election days in which we could hold bond referendums and like within the city, and it seemed like it was a workable situation. We were able to time our referendums and our elections in a proper manner so that we could still make use of funding capabilities and the like. So it seems like a system that could work here as well in Minnesota.
Very good. Any questions on the bill? Anybody in the audience that wanted to testify for or against this bill? Kate, come on down. We'll try to keep our testimony as limited as we can. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Tom Deans. I'm legal counsel of the School Board Association. This bill is opposed by the School Board Association. It's opposed by the League of Cities. It's opposed by the Association of Counties. Let me just say that we believe that this is going to really restrict the rights of local government to set their election dates to coincide with their needs and the needs of their communities. Let me also say that it doesn't matter if you're voting in your community on an issue of importance in your community. If you're voting in the city of Moundsview, you don't particularly care whether they're having an election in the city of Marshall. You people focus on what's going on in their own community. We don't believe that there's disenfranchisement to the extent that we're using combined polling places or other polling places. We mail notices to every household in which a registered voter resides. We think that this is going to increase costs because people are going to miss deadlines and they're going to have to add increased amounts to their bond issues. I will tell you, this affects school districts probably more than other units of government because you require us to vote all the time. We have to submit our capital projects to the voters. Counties don't have to do that with many of theirs. Other units of government are allowed to do lease purchase agreements, which don't are required to go to the voters. School districts are required to submit all their capital projects to the voters. And it happens. And it happens a lot. We need some flexibility in enabling us to get these things out. And we may need, sometimes it takes more than one opportunity to do that because we need to be able to tailor these so that it's what the people in that community need. We cannot just put those kids out in the front yard. We've got to have schools for them. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
For this witness, Representative Kahn.
As I understand it, if a referendum fails for a school, they still have to wait 60 days before they can do it again. Isn't that true?
Ms. Chairman, Representative Kahn, if you're voting on exactly the same issue, exactly the same amount, you have to wait for 180 days.
180 days.
Representative Mueller.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, did you have another follow-up?
Well, this the follow-up. I thought it was 60, but these you can have an election every 60 days. Isn't it? So I don't see why, with that constraint, I don't see quite see what the problem is. Have people tried to hold referendums closer than 60 days?
What's the issue with since we're giving you periodic days?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, if I can give you some examples, let me just say that when we're putting together, you have a building committee that's putting together a bond issue, and they're shooting to get this thing on either the September ballot or the November ballot. Sometimes when they're putting those things together and they're taking that local input, those people at the local level can't reach agreement in that timely manner, and that way, you know, they still have to give the 53-day notice before you get to the to whatever the election date is. So they need to have reached agreement almost 8 weeks before whatever date that is. As you know from around here, sometimes you can't reach agreement exactly the time that you want to, especially when you're dealing with bonding bills and you're dealing with those kinds of capital issues. People decide whether they want to have a new school, whether they want to remodel that existing school. Those discussions at the local level don't automatically fall right into place. And people sometimes, and then if you miss both the September and the November election, you can't levy that fall. So you've got to add capitalized interest to that bond issue and issue more bonds over the next 20 years. That we just think that that's wrong.
Madam Chairman, you can then go in January. The option of having an election, missing the November election, and going and not waiting until January is you get this thing which would be considered pretty offensive this year, where you had elections in Thanksgiving and Christmas period. And I think that the idea of the uniform election days, even if they're not paying attention, that means that the local newspaper, for example, can say this is election day and that there will be much more attention paid for it.
Ms. Chairman, Representative Kahn, you know, sometimes that concept might work, but if you're holding a special election every 5 or 7 years, or every 10 years in that school district, I don't believe that there's a habit that's formed of people showing up at the polling place on that day. Other than the general elections, these other ones are all special elections.
Sure. Well,
Representative Kahn?
Madam Chairman, the point I was making is that it will be easier to have the publicity out for these days because radio stations, television stations, and so forth will be geared. So even if one town isn't paying attention to what another town's doing, those days will be geared to be election days. So I think you'll get much more general publicity, which will fit in with the specific publicity that each town needs. So there'll be reminders out. Besides the campaigning for the day in that town, there'll also be a general reminder out on radio, television.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, in those cities and those school districts, those people know, in Minnesota, those people know when they're voting and they know what they're voting on. There is a lot of information that gets put out to the people. Some would claim too much information.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Madam Chairman, I don't think the voter turnout shows that. I thought the voter turnout tends to be lower than the general election for these, but I don't know that.
Mr. Chairman, some of these bond issues in school districts have a higher voter turnout than you have for the state primary.
Well, then maybe it's a good idea to put them on the state primary day.
That's one of the options, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair.
Representative Mullery.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my district abuts Brooklyn Center, and I guess if there's a prime example of why something is needed to restrict school districts, it's Brooklyn Center. And I get calls all the time, can't you pass something to protect us from our local school district? They have, I don't know, I think they've lost three in a row on almost, you said it takes 180 days. That may be for the exact same thing, but they've done it 60 days, wait 60 days, do it again. I've heard they're going to do it in another 60 days, and people are already saying, why are we even have a school district? It's two precincts. The school district, if they didn't have the Minneapolis students there, I think they lose 60% of their students. I'm not sure, but I think it's a proven example from all the calls I get from Brooklyn Center. Obviously, these people have known me all my life because I've lived in the area, that we have to have something like this, and there's very low turnouts. They set things when there's going to be probably they think they can get their people out, and I just think that we have to put some restrictions on these school districts the way they're acting.
Mr. Chairman, I believe Brooklyn Center is a levy referendum, is it not? And I believe the only reason they were able to have that levy referendum is because they were in statutory operating debt and basically pretty close to going down the chute, and have submitted the thing back to the voters so that they can try to keep the district alive. If the voters don't want to do it, at some point Brooklyn Center will probably cease to exist.
Well, but Mr. Chairman, how many times are you going to keep dragging the voters out when they keep saying no?
Mr. Chairman, that's a local decision. If they don't like what that school board's doing, they'll vote that school board out.
Representative Frankie.
Thank you. When you, in your statements at the beginning, you said the rights of local units of government. I've only been around here 15 years, but can you refer to the Constitution of where the rights of local units of government are?
Mr. Beeman.
Mr. Chairman, if that's the term that I used, I would stand corrected.
Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Deans, I have heard this argument before, but I'm curious, you had mentioned before, well, if you live in New Brighton, you don't necessarily care about what's happening. Marshall was the example used, but what about the obvious fact that we live in a rather transient, almost nomadic type of society? You might live in Marshall one year, and you might live in New Brighton the next. Isn't this bill of benefit to most Minnesotans who now move every couple, 3 years or so, that they don't have to constantly try and stay informed as to when the vote is going to be in a particular town or city in which they live?
Mr. Dean.
Ms. Chairman, when school districts hold elections that are other than in conjunction with the statewide election, they send a mailing to each household in which a registered voter resides. By statute.
No, No need to belabor the point, Madam Chair, but most people don't seriously read through every piece of mail they get from government, I would imagine. I don't. I just simply think Mr. Deans is a benefit to be able to move from one town to one city to the next to know when the voting day is. It makes sense to me. It seems intuitive. I must be missing something. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Forrest, we've had the general election day the second Tuesday, the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November for 100 years. I'd like to see you go down to your district and ask people when the general election day is.
Well, now, Madam Chair, it sounds like you're making a judgment about particular folks. You represent back home in your district.
I'm going to my district, too.
I've got plenty of faith in the folks in my district.
All right, let's move on. Let's move on to the next witness. Could you please state your name for the...
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ann Higgins. I'm from the League of Minnesota Cities, and I echo what Mr. Deans has already said, but also just to add one other point, which has been made before, is simply that Minnesota has a strong tradition of local home rule for cities and one county, Ramsey. That means they have created their own structure of government under a form of law that you have put in effect. And one of those areas that I think is of some interest in the House in particular is that that authority also includes the opportunity to have initiative and referendum. And that involves a petitioning process in which, under the current home rule charters that have that in them, and that's about 80, there are about 106 or 107 cities with charters, about 80 with initiative and referendum. There, that will mean they will have to change that petitioning process, which of course they can do. That's obvious if this is a choice you want to make, but my point in saying it is simply that the voters there have already indicated through their assent to the charter that they have, and in not replacing it all this time with a more regular schedule, that they want the flexibility to be able to respond to a situation that they feel is urgent and to be able to bring the petition at 60 days later or whatever the time frame is that they put in the charter, that election takes place. And they're in charge. The voters are in charge. So I just want to urge you to think about that. And I guess the only other point that I would make is that cities generally do try to use the November general election, but it's absolutely clear that when there are either public improvement projects that can't be timed in that way, that they do seek the need for other ones. And while they might be able to use the fourth Tuesday in January or one of the other dates in May or whenever or in March, often bond council tries to help figure out when that cost of the interest is going to be at its most optimum to reduce the debt burden that the community will have as a result. And so trying to time that doesn't necessarily mean that those dates are the ones that you would prefer to choose in every situation. And there are some gaps that are longer depending on where you fall on that timeline. Finally, the only other point I would make is that when we have emergencies at the local level, we sometimes are in a situation where we need to get to the ballot as quickly as we can and take care of a matter that involves getting approval from the voters. At the League, we try very hard to encourage our cities to be very conscious of their responsibilities to try to work with the local voters on when those elections should be served. We're doing, I think, a better job than we used to because we have more means to make voters aware of when elections are coming. Between the Internet and more of the cable access services that are available now and the local newspapers and newsletters that are getting out there, in addition to those official notices, I think we don't see the outcry at the local level that I would suggest maybe would mean we ought to take a look at this. I think what Mr. Deans has pointed out is, in fact, what we observe as well. Thank you.
Any questions for this witness? Seeing none, anyone else that wishes to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, the chair will lay over this bill for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President.
This one is on the House floor as well.
Yes, yeah.
And where is it in the Senate?
Representative Biskins, where is this in the Senate?
In committee.
In committee? Okay. Very good. Okay, Representative Dean, I think we're going to take Representative Dean, Emmer, Erickson, and Loeffler. I've been scanning the room trying to see who's been popping in and out. Oh, I see Westrum's here too, so
Okay. Representative Dean, why don't you come up? I know you've been sitting there a long time. I'm not. It's tough to see sometimes with everybody here. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is House File 2961, which you have in front of you. I'd like this be held over for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. I also do have an author's amendment, which may or may not be in the packets. I don't know if it reaches.
Move House File 2961 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. I believe it's the A2 amendment where you're deleting
the
page 2, lines 25 to 35.
25 to 35, correct.
Okay.
I'd make that motion.
All right. And any discussion on this? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Okay. The bill's in the shape the author wants, so please explain the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is the pay-for-performance bill, and those of you who were listening during the Governor's State of the State address, this is a proposal that has been put forward that would hold legislators and the governor accountable for production and work. It is an attempt to tie accountability with results in the legislature, just as we are asking our educators and people in the healthcare and obviously people in business to do. What this basically does, it's in two pieces. If you look at the bill, it is withholding salary and compensation for legislators in two pieces. The first piece is for odd-numbered years. The second piece is for even-numbered years, and that corresponds to our budget cycles. And for a budget year, it says that if we pass all our omnibus bills and present them to the governor, that we have satisfied our work. And in the non-budget year, that if we have, by virtue of a forecast, or if we're operating in deficit mode, we have to fix it in that year too. And if we don't do that, we need to fall under this provision. This has been a very, very discussed topic in my district. It's been very popular with folks that I have talked to. This seems like a very common sense piece of legislation to the people in my district, and also to the people around the state that have contacted me regarding this. And it's been cause for very good debate, and I think it's a common sense piece of legislation that we owe it to our constituents to move on.
Very good. Anyone in the audience would like to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, Representative Kahn and then Solberg.
Chairman, the problem of getting distracted for a minute and thinking about something else is, did you give any reason for, we passed an amendment to your bill in the Government Operations Committee. It was an amendment that had been offered by Representative Mark Olson, and it was passed on a bipartisan vote. Was it a roll call, maybe even? Was it a roll call? I mean, we just apparently just took it out, just like that. And I don't know if anyone was paying attention.
We were not.
To what I don't think anyone was doing it, was paying attention to that. And I'd like to have...
I don't even know what it did.
Right. That's what I think happened. So can I just have reconsideration of that last...
Okay, let's...
I'd like to reconsider it, and then we can have discussion of reconsideration of the H2961A2. I'd like
that's
to
not debatable. Those in favor of reconsideration of the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Okay, we'll allow the courtesy of having this back before us. What does this amendment do now? Or what does the language do that you would like to have in, Representative Kahn?
Well, what the language did was this said that they didn't apply, was that there's an exemption from forfeiture, that the salary and the other forfeiture provisions of this section didn't apply to members of the legislature who aren't part of a legislative committee, conference committee, or other subgroup, whenever the committee, conference committee, or other subgroup prevents a majority of the full House of Representatives to from taking legislative... There are a whole bunch of people involved in the government shutdown, and it wasn't their fault. You know, there's nothing that they could do to... As those of us who kept voting for Mark Olson's motion or whatever it was, kept finding that there was resolution. There was nothing. there's nothing that they could do. So the question is, why should those people suffer forfeiture of salary? And then the other question is, if the governor causes it because he's vetoed one or more budget bills and the veto necessitates a special session, that's the second part that was just put back in, you know, why shouldn't the governor's salary be forfeit? And we had quite a discussion about it in the GovOps committee, and that set, and these were amended into the bill. And so I don't think, you know, maybe there's an argument that I missed, and maybe we should take them out, but I certainly don't think we should do it without thinking about it. And if I was the only person who wasn't thinking about it, I apologize, but it seemed to go very quickly.
So
I think it was deserved more discussion than
we had.
I
remember talking about this, wasn't it? It was unworkable, that we don't even know what subgroup is. Like, we couldn't figure out if it was the Rules Committee, the leadership.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Dean, do you remember this? I thought it was unworkable, but
yeah.
Representative Olson would never propose such a thing. But
well,
are you accusing Representative Olson?
No, I know he would never. You know, I don't think it works.
I am. I am sometimes in the Representative Olson fan club myself. However, in this particular piece, I opposed it for two reasons. Number one, it goes against the spirit of the bill, which is that it's not about who's at fault, but it's about accountability at the legislature. And number two, it just plain doesn't work. You can't specifically say what is a subgroup, what's a minority, who's at fault. These are just weenie words that allow anybody to get out from under the the blame. They can. It's very easy to point fingers and say that you're not part of a subgroup or a committee. And also, it does not address special session legislation, which we could not put dates on. So those are the three reasons that I opposed it. I think it doesn't work, and it also does not go against.
Well,
it doesn't fit with the spirit of the bill.
Representative Kahn, one of the things we asked about in GovOps that we didn't get a clear answer on is, let's go back to July. Who would not have gotten their salary if this was law? And nobody really answered the question. So we said, we'll go to state gov and figure it out, and we'll take it out if it doesn't work.
Well,
and what's the answer? Who we can name
I
names if
works.
You want. I just, who would have?
I think it works. I think, for example, the majority leadership of both houses is completely implicated in this. Because the majority can clearly can.
So who would that be? Would that be Ann Rest, for example, or does she only Dean Johnson, your senator,
Well, the major ones, would, I think the one where it's very clearly is any conference committee that hasn't come to an agreement. I think that's clearly, you're not in a conference committee that hasn't come to an agreement.
What if you represent Prinky, or you? You
what
were
happens if you resign from the conference committee?
Then you're okay.
Then you're okay.
Representative Solberg,
well, Mr. Chairman, there obviously is a strong definition of what a conference committee is.
Yeah.
There may not be, or a definition of our other subgroup.
Well, a legislative committee may not have come up with passed the bill, so it may not have gotten to conference committee.
I understand that, but
well, let's take
but then the whole legislature. But it seems to me that there is a definite at fault for the conference committee. In fact, is Mr. Chairman, you said I'm not at fault many, many times. That it's even in your campaign literature.
Not yet. Not yet. I haven't printed any.
No, I've been in your campaign literature.
There's five members on this table. We got done, right?
But what I'm saying is that there's a clear definition of what a conference committee is. So if we don't know what our other subgroup is, let's at least take that out and then do the conference committee. So I would propose, if it's in order, on line 2.27, to delete or other subgroup, and then it would read, and then also the committee.
You're amending the amendment.
And so I'm deleting, would read the conference committee whenever the conference committee prevents a majority.
Okay, I think that would be an amendment for next. I think we have to talk about A2, and that amendment wouldn't work in the A2. So we've reconsidered A2, so we have to either vote this up or down first, and then we can do your piece
okay.
if that gets voted down. Okay, so our discussion is the A2 right now.
Well, we can have an amendment to the amendment, can't we?
Mr. Shepard,
yeah.
Get
right.
An amendment.
The
amendment.
Yes.
The amendment. Reconsider.
But it's a different amendment.
It was before us, but how, you know.
You have to delete the entire other amendment in order to move.
Okay. We actually could do this with amending, but it would be very complicated.
Right.
I would suggest that we agree to delete the A2 amendment, and we work on this, and then if we don't agree, we'll put it back in. You know, we then consider, if we can't fix this so that it makes sense to the members of this committee, then the next motion would be to reinstate to redo the A2 amendment.
Hey, what say you, committee?
Let's vote on A2.
Yeah, vote it.
Okay. Those in favor of A2 say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
I'll ask for division on that one. Those in favor of A2, raise your hand.
1, 2, 3.
Those opposed to A2, raise your hand. Okay, I don't have very good ears today. All right, now we are on the bill. The amendment is off. And Representative Solberg has the floor.
Well, let me try to fix it. If it works, if it doesn't work, that's on what I suggested on 2.27. If I delete or other subgroup, and then the next committee after that, that line would read, conference committee whenever the conference committee prevents a majority. And then on page 2.28, delete the comma or other subgroup as well.
Okay. Any discussion to that amendment?
Well, see if that works with conference.
Yeah.
Representative Kahn?
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman, I fix it up by saying committee who are not part of the conference, I'd leave the legislative committee in. Because that would cover the rules committee, might be someone that's not. So then as legislative committee or, so then you need an or in there, or conference committee, because you're taking out the or other subgroup.
That would make a, I would
just put the
that.
Or in there, so that you're doing both of those two.
Hey, Representative Solberg, do you have that?
Yes, I concluded that.
Okay. Mr. Shepard, could you read what the amendment is before we vote then?
Mr. Chair and members, on page 2, line 20, delete line 27 and insert instead, committee or conference committee whenever the conference, that would be line 27, and then on line 28, delete comma or other subgroup. I believe,
no.
Is that?
No, that doesn't mean, yes, it does.
No.
That's
yep,
right.
That's
no.
Right.
Yep. That's what I had.
So can you read the sentence for us with the amendment?
Yes. Madam, Mr. Chair and members, as I understand Representative Solberg's amendment, the entire sentence would read from the top of line 25, the salary and other forfeiture provisions of this section do not apply to members of the legislature who are not part of a legislative committee or conference committee whenever, and then it should say, whenever the committee or conference committee prevents a majority of the full House. So I will make it.
Mm-hmm. But you left out.
I left okay. out a word the first time. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And if I could just have that read back again, I still am not sure on line 228 what that says. And then I might have a question of what that how that might apply. If I could just have that read back one more time, please.
You want Mr. Shepard to read that back again?
Please.
Okay, Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, members, on line 20, delete line 27, and in place of it, insert committee or conference committee whenever the committee or conference, and then, Mr. Chair, on line 28, delete comma or other subgroup.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Once again, I think just from a conceptual standpoint, this goes against the theme of the bill, which is really about accountability, not fault. It's not about pointing fingers or absolving oneself of responsibility in a process that is shared. Just as we are responsible to our committees and to each other, we are also responsible to our constituents. So I think this just flies in the face of the bill's intent in itself. I'm still somewhat, if we want to take a trip back on memory lane and we look to the last night of the legislative session before shutdown, and the folks in the room who had signed off and shook hands, and yet there was a Senate body that left with time on the clock, I'm not quite sure who would be caught on this hook for that day for my constituents, and maybe someone on the committee, perhaps Representative Solberg or Representative Kahn might replay that last hour of, if we replay the videotape of that last hour of session, how would this have affected any one of those folks who were making the decisions that sent us home and sent the DOT employees off without a paycheck?
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Dean. I would speak against the amendment. I agree with you. I think that this is, of course, I'm coming from a freshman perspective, but I think that this is watering the bill down, and it is assigning blame when it should be addressing the real problem. And the second reason I'm not going to vote for the amendment is because I think it's poorly worded and has a double negative in it.
No, you got to keep in mind, everyone, that 2.25 to 2.35 is entirely in the bill, right, Mr. Shepard? So, I mean, I don't know if it makes it watered down or not. It's difficult to tell. Representative Kahn?
Well, I think the important thing is to hold accountable the people who deserve to be held accountable, not those who don't deserve to be accountable. And I think taking out the confusion, the other subgroup, I agree, is not good language. But I think I don't see a circumstances under which I don't think there were any conference committees that had shaken hands and we didn't get it done because the Senate adjourned. The Senate sent us a lights on bill and then adjourned. And I don't think I still think it's still the, you could say, I don't know if there's anything that the Rules Committee, which I've never been on, could facilitate in doing that, but I think it's clearly the members of the conference committees who did not come to agreement.
Okay, any other discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay?
No.
Oh.
You got good hearing.
That passed. Why don't we just ask for a division and see who those in favor of the amendment, raise your hand. Okay, it passes 6. Okay. Any other discussion? The chair will lay over the bill. Thank you, Representative Dean.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Krenke, did you have an amendment?
I had an amendment.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
We'll bring it back. I didn't see your name on the list. Go ahead.
A small,
We got other members waiting, so I don't want to sit here all night.
On page 1, line 11, I would just add after failure to enact, I would add it an A. After the word budget, without tax increases. And on page 2, after the, on line 12, after after year, on line 12, same thing. Does not increase taxes.
Yeah. Representative Dean?
Mr. Chairman, can I speak my mind?
Oh, Representative Krenke. I thought it was kind of self-explanatory, but...
Well, it's somewhat self-explanatory, but I think the problem with Representative Dean's legislation is that it just says what the legislature produces a product. There's no different definition of what the product is. So I've offered one amendment. Another way to approach this would be say that a budget that doesn't increase more than the cost of living. But again, I think
to just say, well, we're not going to pay legislators, or legislators are going to have to forfeit some portion of salary, just means that, well, let's pass a budget. We don't really care because we don't want to lose our salary. We don't want to forfeit the compensation. So any product is a good product as long as we get out of here on time. And I am not one of those people that felt that the additional time spent during the legislative session last year was some reason to chastise those of us who endeavored to try to come to resolution. But rather, let's talk about the quality of the product, not just the product.
Representative Dean?
And Mr. Chair, I'd ask for a roll call vote.
Mr. Chair, Representative Prinke, I share your zeal in passing bills without raising taxes, and I look to you for advice, counsel, and sometimes often admonition on those particular issues. And no one will be working harder than I will on the floor to make sure that we do that without raising taxes. However, I see that as a separate issue, one that should be for debate and for vigorous debate on the floor. Not for the purposes of this bill, which are, again, to try to link accountability with results. I understand where you're going, and I appreciate your intent, and I will work very hard with you to make to realize that intent. However, that's different than the purpose of the bill, and therefore I would ask that members not support the Krenke Amendment.
Representative Krenke, and then Finstead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean, I think you, what area of work do you practice in?
Right now.
let me just put it this way, that as someone who has spent a career in the construction industry, I think we are all familiar with the idea of a penalty clause in the construction business. In other words, if we fail to perform the work on time, there's a penalty clause. But that doesn't mean that you get to cut corners when you're trying to achieve the work on time. You still have to meet all of the criteria within the scope of the contract in order to deliver the project on time. So it's on time, on budget. It's not just on time. So I think, as I said before, the problem with or what I see as the weakness in this proposal is that it doesn't set a standard for what we're going to achieve. And I think it's very important to communicate to the people of the state of Minnesota that we're going to do this without increasing their taxes.
I have Finstead, De La Forest, Mallory, and Kahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Krenke is on to something, or on something. probably on to something. You know, this whole bill, Representative Dean, you talked about accountability, which, you know, is great, the noble cause we all, I mean, I think, strive to be accountable. But one of the problems that I see with this bill is, with accountability, you need to have measured results to be accountable for. In my district, my constituents might think me being accountable is not raising taxes. A Representative Kahn's district might be, you know what, we're going to hold her accountable by measuring how much she did, programs, how much she can raise, whatever it may be. But we each have different measuring tools or different things that our constituents measure our accountability based on. So just by saying this bill is going to create accountability, I think it's hogwash. I don't know. Representative Seifert and I were at a meeting this summer in my district, and people at that meeting applauded some of the things that we didn't do. So they were measuring our accountability on what we didn't do. And to me, just by, I mean, there's a lot of holes with this proposal. So I think we should just start building in accountability tools, measuring tools in this building. So if Representative Krenke wants to do it without raising taxes, we can go on and on then. We can define right now in committee what we're going to be measured on and what we're going to be held accountable for then. Representative Krenke talked about his job and the clauses for missing deadlines. That's a pretty specific area of practice. If you're building a house, you know how many 2x6s go into that house, how many nails, approximately you know, how long it takes to frame up the house, how to shingle the house. I mean, that's very measurable results. So, of course, you can easily be held accountable to timelines, you know, with the exception of maybe rain, weather, or whatever it may be. But there's a lot of defined steps to reach the accountability. And I just don't... Good idea, bad bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinston, to that I would just say that if you're a homeowner and you hire a contractor to do... to deliver a project and you have liquidated damages that say that I want to move into my house on May 1st and I want it to be this color yellow and I have a array of specifications from everything from door hardware to carpet to faucets, they really don't care if the plumber was late and if it's not the general contractor's fault, it's the plumber's fault, no, it's the excavator's fault, no, it's the landscaper's fault. With the individual contract with a homeowner, there is only one person who is responsible, and that's the contractor. And the beauty of the situation is that the homeowner can say, for every day that I'm not in, I get $1,000 from you, Mr. Contractor, and I really don't care whose fault it is. And I think that's really what the public is saying to us as a legislature, that they want some results, and they're really not interested in finger-pointing.
All right.
Okay, we need to kind of move along. We have people that are waiting for their bills. So I've got Finstead briefly, and then De La Forest, and Mallory, then Kahn, then Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my comeback to that, Representative Dean, would be we do have an accountability tool, and it's called an election.
Yep.
We all stand for election. My constituents will measure my accountability by electing me or not.
Representative De La Forest?
Mr. Chairman, my question is not to the amendment.
Representative Mallory?
Well, Mr. Chairman, and I agree with your word hogwash, except that's too nice. I think you have to be out of your mind to think this is a good idea. But Representative Krinke, I hope that since I do construction law and you're in construction, basically what this is when you get into conference committee is the negotiations that go on in a lawsuit. And in a lawsuit, though, you have the final, you go to trial. There isn't a trial here. So what you're doing is saying, okay, we're going to negotiate like in a lawsuit. And what you're doing is saying, okay, I'm going to penalize my attorney if he doesn't get an agreement within a certain amount of time. And I hope, geez, I wish that everybody I had to negotiate lawsuits with over the years was that way, that they had an employee or that their client was saying, you have to negotiate it by this time or else you're out. Because, geez, I'd be a fantastic negotiator under those terms. And it just doesn't make any sense.
Representative Kahn?
Well, I guess I don't think the Krinke amendment, I can agree with disagreeing about the whole bill, but I don't think that the Krinke amendment makes any more sense than putting specific numbers, you know, that you can't have a budget increase of more than a certain percentage. That's why we have targets. That's why we have budget resolutions and things like that. So I guess even if you think you're voting against no taxes, I certainly don't think it makes any sense in a bill like this.
Because I'm healthy.
Makes less sense than the bill itself.
Very briefly, first of all, Mr. Chair, thank you. I agree totally with Representative Finstead, and I just wanted to point out about the homeowner analogy. That doesn't quite work because a homeowner may be speaking with one voice, but our constituents are not speaking with one voice. A better analogy might be a situation in which you had a whole family that was having a house constructed and they didn't really agree on anything.
Seeing no further discussion, the Krinke amendment, we have a roll call, so the clerk will take the roll.
Blaine?
Yes.
De La Forest?
Yes.
Finstead?
No.
Hilty?
No.
Kahn?
No.
Krinke?
Yes.
Mallory?
No.
Pepin?
Yes.
Solberg?
No.
And Seifert?
Yes. In five ayes and five nays, amendments not adopted. Any other amendments?
The chair will leave the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
I know the bill is being laid over, but this bill didn't come to civil law, and I just, Representative Dean, in my opinion here, if this bill goes anywhere, subdivision 5 on page 2, I believe is blatantly unconstitutional.
Okay, thank you. Representative Emmer has numerous children waiting for him at home, so we're going to kind of move him up here quick.
I just wrote it.
Chair will move House Bill 1596 for quick inclusion, possibly in the omnibus bill. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This first bill has to do with loitering or, let's say, campaigning around the polling place. It is a freedom to vote bill, in essence. It's a modification of existing law. And I have, if you will allow me, a brief verbal amendment to address an issue that came up in the Civil Law Committee, which I understand there's been agreement on from the League of Minnesota Cities and the counties.
Okay. Anyone feel compelled to
say? I said the counties. I misspoke, Mr. Chairman. It's the townships.
Townships, okay.
The amendment would be as follows. On line 1.11, change the number 100 to 200. And then with the insert beginning with property line, change that to, it should read 200 feet of the entrances. Or adjacent designated parking area. I'm going to have Mr. Hansen read it to you. My writing's not very good.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it'd be 200 feet from the entrance to the building or designated parking lot adjacent. The adjacent parking area of any private or public parcel of property. So and take out property line and add an entrance to the building or
designated
adjacent parking lot.
Everybody understand that amendment? Any discussion on that amendment?
Well,
I don't know what it is.
Some Maury?
I think we need that read back, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Read the way the language
is. Mr. Read the way the language is. For Ms. McKnight, whoever wants to jump in on. Do you have it written down, or do you need Mr. Hansen to kind of.
Mr. Chair, let me try this. Is it page 1, line 11?
Right.
You're going to strike 100 and insert 200 at that point?
100 and insert 200, yes.
And then you're deleting property line.
Right.
And inserting entrance to the building or designated adjacent parking lot.
Parking lot or parking area, whichever you want.
A specific parking point area that you can reference is basically.
Right.
Okay.
And that same amendment would go on line 2.1 and also on 2.7. So that all the language is the same all the way through.
Any discussion on that?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's
not guilty.
That still doesn't read right if we don't do anything with line 12.
Are you deleting line 12?
No.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't understand how those go together then.
Would you like me to read it back, Mr. Chairman? Because I think it does. And if we start, Representative Hilty, from the point where it says, or within 200 feet of the entrance or adjacent designated parking area of, that's where that goes in. So you just continue on with of any private or public parcel of property. Yep. So all we did was remove the words property line. Does that make more sense to the members and Representative Hilty?
And this bill has had second reading, by the way. This is just something in case. Is this in the Senate moving or not really?
It's somewhat stalled in the Senate as well.
Somewhat stalled,
me.
Okay.
It looks like right. Your whole bill has been stalled.
Okay. Representative Mallory?
Mr. Chairman,
I'd like to know, what was the, there was a court decision on this type of language, and what did that say? There was some question. The court threw out some statutes that we had, and I'm...
Mr. Knight, do you have anything? I don't believe it's been challenged. But
Mr. Chair, Representative Mallory, I'm not familiar with the case you're thinking about. Can you tell us a little more?
There was.
I talked with all the other members, and they didn't think that this had been challenged yet.
Well,
Representative Mallory, you're an attorney.
But there was a case that threw out something like this that was in the statute.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mallory, I'm not familiar with any case that addresses this particular situation. And just for information, perhaps Representative Hilty can add to the discussion, since the property line discussion was had in civil law, we're trying to address an issue of clarity.
Well, Mr. Chair, I agree that there's a problem with property line, and the amendment would definitely improve that, although I think the discussion that we had in civil law did not include changing the 100 to 200.
Yeah.
But just as a procedural question, Mr. Chair, if the committee is not in possession of this bill, is it possible to amend it?
No, we're doing a pretend amendment again. So we don't have possession of the bill. It would basically be getting ideas from them. Representative Kahn.
Could someone explain how this works in places like, for example, one of my polling places is in Kauffman Union on the university campus. So where there are, for example, within the building, there are UDFL has offices, GOP has offices. Do they have to clear out of those? They're nowhere near the polling place. The polling place is only on the ground floor, and they're all on the upper floors. But I don't understand how that, and I have real problems with the 200 feet. I mean, 100 feet certainly seems wrong, and I haven't fully, you know, when we have a complicated amendment that affects the structure of this, I'd really like to see it as an engrossment. I think it would be helpful.
Representative Elmer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, first, the 200 is actually, that's a compromise, as I understand it, and I'll have, the answer to your question is no, this would not affect the normal activities that are going on in the building. But why don't I let Mr. Hansen address that more in more detail for you?
But if those normal activities have to deal with elections and posting signs and that kind of thing, I don't quite see how it wouldn't be affected.
It's also vertical.
Mr. Chairman and members, if you take a look, the key word is stand. You're talking about this has to do with loitering. Folks that are literally loitering in the area to impact someone's freedom to vote. In other words, they're within that 200 feet, they would be attempting to influence the vote. And again, I'll have Mr. Hansen explain that further for you.
And we're not going to vote on the amendment because we're not, you know, we don't have formal possession of the bill. Just to get the concepts out that Representative Emmer wanted to.
Okay.
Mr. Hansen?
I would also like to see it as an engrossment before we vote on it, because I'm having trouble.
And we're just going to lay it over. We're not going to vote on amendments. We're not voting on the bill.
Okay.
Mr. Hansen.
Chairman Seifert, Representatives Kahn, this bill is to address many questions that came to our office and to the cities and to the counties and to the townships and to other people that were running elections, including election judges, where people were complaining of the distance. They felt like they were being harassed. This is to try to address that concern that we've been hearing from voters in many different areas, and it's to provide a shield area in which campaigning and other practices don't occur right immediately around the polling place. In the case of Kauffman Memorial Union, as the current statute reads, it says none of those activities are allowed on the public property. Kauffman Memorial Union is part of the public property, so in this sense, it wouldn't be allowed anyways at this point in time, so the exemption still existed then as it does now. There is no change in the situation with Kauffman because the current statute says on the public property, in which Kauffman Memorial Union is public property, from my understanding. And the 100-foot distance was 100 foot from the property line. We're moving it to 200. It might be a little further away than 100 feet from the you know, it depends upon how far away the building is from the edge of the property line, whether that extends the distance or it makes it closer. This changes the starting point of that 100-foot as opposed to the end point of the 100-foot, possibly. So,
Representative Solberg?
Mr. Chairman, I want to address my concern on 2.6 and go back in history a little bit. My father-in-law is 97 years old, lives in South Dakota. But his sisters sat for years in every election as poll watchers. They sat in their car and checked off who went and voted. And, of course, in South Dakota, they have registration of who it was. And about 6 o'clock, they would call people and encourage them to come out and vote. This would say a person may not keep a record of individuals arriving or departing from a polling place. What? Are you going to throw me in jail if I do? That doesn't make any sense. Or within 100 feet of the polling place, ask whether the individual has voted, or I can see that. But I don't know what kind of a problem that's solving.
Representative Emmer, Mr. Hansen.
Chairman Seifert, Representative Solberg, currently inside the polling place, you're not allowed to take a list of who has come and voted and who has not. This is just extending the distance a little further away from that distance. It is actually a violation of Minnesota statute to take a list of that currently in the polling place.
Well, I understand it in the polling place, but, I mean, what's wrong with that? And someone setting it out and then encouraging other people to vote afterwards.
There's nothing, Chairman Seifert, Representative Solberg, there's nothing wrong with that if they're 200 feet from the entrance to the polling place.
Are we discovering that you're breaking all sorts of laws unknowingly over here? Or, okay. There was a Mallory.
Certainly.
Mr. Chairman, I know there was a decision on this, and I don't know if it's a Hennepin County decision or what. But this is not the Freedom to Vote Act. It's the abridge the freedom of the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution Act. You're taking away the right to speak on an issue, and not only are you doing that now on public, but you're going to apply it to private property. And it goes even further. What if you're standing on your own private property next to a lawn sign?
Or waving a lawn sign or something.
Or just standing next to one that's on your private property. That's a violation, it looks like to me.
Mr. Hansen?
Chairman Seifert, Representative, it is currently, if it's within 100 feet of the entrance to a polling place and there is a yard sign within that 100 feet from that polling place, it is still a violation at this point in time. This is changing distance and location. It is quite common that election judges go out in front of a polling place and remove yard signs from people across the street. They don't like it individually, and I don't think the election judges like to do it either, but that is what the statute says at this point in time.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that argument, you're going to have to remove more. You're going to have them go out and remove more.
Any other
shooting
discussion on this bill, Representative Kahn?
Well, I just don't think that that's true. I think, for example, the polling place may be defined as the room, and I don't know of any election judges that have ever. But hey, if the lawn sign is located there before, I mean, if someone were to hold a lawn sign within 100 feet of it, you know, I think there would be objections at some, but I have never heard of any objection to lawn signs that are right next to polling places. In fact, I don't think that's considered that you place them there on election day. You know, that there's any relation to it.
I think we have to be careful that we don't, you know, there's a philosophy that every perceived problem, we can pass a law to solve it. And if someone really wants to get around it, they'll find a way to do it. I think that this is the perceived problem, that we're going to solve the problem, and someone will get around a way to be able to ask somebody, have you voted? I can ask within 200 feet, I can't ask within 199 feet, you know.
No.
If we're going to take testimony, Representative Kahn.
Well, this is the other issue that I think that we were arguing about last year, which I don't remember how it came out. This was the issue about whether if someone left the polling place and then came back, were they allowed to vote? And I don't remember how that came out. But one of the issues, one of the reasons why people stay around.
It didn't.
What?
It didn't.
So it's still, well, one of the reasons why people stay around is if people don't know what they're supposed to do to be able to answer the question. It's not that they're harassing people. It's just that people sometimes need some extra information as they're going to vote, and not necessarily even about candidates, just about what you need in order to have to register and so forth.
Let's take testimony. So, Ms. Fraser, it looks like you want to testify for or against the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Beth Fraser, and I'm working with the Voting Rights Coalition. Thank you for allowing me to testify. We have concerns about the bill, and what's been interesting is that the committee's discussion so far has really focused on Subdivision 2, which has to do with campaigning and where one can campaign. Our concerns are actually more about the first subdivision, which has to do with anyone doing any activity. It says that, you know, people may not be in the building or on the property. Given that we have elections in, you know, polling places in churches and schools, it doesn't seem like there could be church meetings. The kids couldn't go out on the playground. It seems like if one were to interpret this literally, which I think is how we're supposed to interpret the law, there would be many problems with saying that no one other than voters and elections officials can be within 200 feet of the entrance to the building or the adjacent parking area. We are primarily concerned with this because we ran a nonpartisan election protection program and did station volunteers outside of some precincts. We did not harass voters. We did not ask if they had voted. We were simply there with a big sign that said, "You have the right to vote." And if people had questions or needed some help, we were there to provide it. And we're worried that if we had to be 200 feet from the parking lot, that we would not be in a position where people would be able to see us and access the information.
Any questions for the witness?
Mr. Chairman, as you read this, and as I think you're raising a point, and do you see it? I see it that some old couple, if it's hot out on some day, they couldn't even sit out on their lawn because they're within this distance. I mean, this is absurd. Is that the way it sounds? It sounds like you're reading verbatim, and that's what I see it as saying.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, yes, that is my understanding. The other thing is that right now there are two different subdivisions because there are two different distances. It says people doing anything can be within 100 feet of the door to the room, and anyone campaigning has to be further away. If you're going to have the same distance, which I don't think you should, but if you were going to, it would make sense to only have one subdivision instead of repeating the information.
I see that as a standalone, it's already gotten second reading on the floor. So, I mean, obviously, it's already been through the process. Okay, any other questions? Okay, that bill will be laid over. Representative Emmer, you've got another one here. Chair will move House Bill 3715 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. This is striking one sentence from law.
37. This, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this has to do with absentee ballots and folks that get them in late being treated the same as others in terms of having to re-register when they miss, I believe it's four election cycles. And I'll have two election cycles. I'll have Mr. Hansen from the Secretary of State's office explain it further.
Mr. Hansen.
Chairman Seifert, members of the committee, this bill is an attempt to try to treat all voters equal in the sense that currently under the Minnesota statute, if you arrive at your polling place, even if it's because of some situation beyond your control, like you get caught in a major traffic accident on 94 on the way home from work between two intersections and you can't get off the road in time to make it to your polling place, you do show up at your polling place 1 minute after 8 o'clock, you don't get credit for attempting to vote. What this does, what currently in statute, gives credit for an absentee ballot that arrives late, so you didn't mail it on time in order to get there. Or it wasn't delivered on time by the post office. And if it wasn't delivered on time by the post office, of course, that's beyond your control. But the situation that I just described to you is also beyond your control. We treat voters differently and therefore unfairly. We think we should treat them in the same manner.
Any questions?
Well,
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I agree with Mr. Hansen that we should treat voters equally, and he's right that in current law or rule we do not. But I think we should be going in the other direction rather than trying to render even more voters who clearly did not intend to be inactive. What we should be doing is trying to establish some means of causing those people that arrive 5 minutes late to be counted as in a way that would keep them on the rolls. Why do we want to keep taking people off rather than putting them on?
Okay. Any other people that want to... Were you going to testify in this bill, too? Okay. Representative Conwell, she's taking the stand.
My problem about this is that the person who arrives 5 minutes late knows that they didn't get to vote. The person who submits a late absentee ballot thinks that they did vote. And so that's there's a serious difference between that. And, you know, I don't know how many people arrive 1 minute or 5 minutes late or something. I don't think most of the time in all the places where we've had people voting late, they've always let everyone who was there at the time. So I don't think that's a problem. The major problem I have with this is that the person wouldn't know it until they arrive at the polling place and found that they had been stricken from it. But I think I added this language at some point.
Okay. Ms. Frazier?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Beth Frazier with the Voting Rights Coalition. I would echo the comments of Representatives Hilty and Kahn. It seems like voters should be marked inactive and be forced to re-register to vote, if ever, only when they have not shown any interest in participating in our civic life. And if somebody has mailed in an absentee ballot, then they have shown that they are interested in participating, and we would argue should continue to be on the list with the active status. And I think the way to fix the problem of unequal treatment of voters is, as Representative Hilty said, to make accommodations for anyone who arrives late. Thank you.
Any questions? Yeah, that bill will be laid over for possible inclusion. The next bill is 3369. The chair will move House Bill 3369 for possible inclusion. Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, members, House File 3865 has to do with combined... 3865? What did you jump to?
3369.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry.
That's okay.
House File 3369 has to do with establishment of polling places. It affects cities and townships. And again, Mr. Jim Hansen from the Secretary of State's office will explain it further.
Mr. Hansen?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you again. This bill is to, again, create some consistency in the mind of the voters that when they're voting, they vote in the same place as usual and predictable. It creates a consistency in some thoughts of where they're going to vote, and they kind of know over a period of time where that is.
Questions? Local governments on board with this, or not really, or township persons coming down to testify? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sillum with the Minnesota Association of Townships. We have been in discussions with Mr. Hansen trying to find a way to address our concerns, but particularly with the current HAVA laws, you're going to see more townships that have the need to combine and share polling places in November are still needing to have their town hall for the March elections, thus the need to do two designations in a year and not just one. I think we may be getting near an agreement on that, but we don't have the language at this time.
Okay. How fast can you guys put this together? The next 24 hours, perhaps? Okay, let's work on that. Any other questions? Okay, that bill will be laid over. The chair will move consideration of House File 3865. The last one we have for you, Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House File this time, 3865, has to do with combined polling places, and I will again have Mr. Jim Hansen from the Secretary of State's office explain it for you.
Mr. Hansen?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is to put a situation in where primary and general elections would be held on the same location for the same effective election of candidates to public office.
Questions?
Is that ever not? Chairman, is that ever not the?
Mr. Hansen, is there situations where we have primaries in one place? I mean, I understand this allows for, like, fires or tornadoes, I assume.
Yes. Representative Chairman Seifert, Representative Kahn, yes, it does have that exemption in case the building is destroyed or removed. But there is the situation that, yeah, at times they combine polling places for a primary and then spread them back out for a general election so that there are actually two different voting places, one for the primary, one for the general election. We don't think that should be the case.
Yeah. Representative Kahn, do you have another question? Or?
Well, I don't think I've ever seen that happen. This must happen in some small places, so it's requiring some very small towns to have many more polling places open than they would on primary.
Be either one or the other. It'd be the more combination or more separation, but they haven't figured
both
out.
Both of them.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it's a problem in any place with any population, which does... you know, which would have that, but I'm not sure. I think it creates a worse problem than it solves. You don't give the flexibility. You don't give the flexibility to either have polling places close by or to.
Okay. Any other questions, Representative Mallory?
Mr. Chairman, you know. Initially, this sounded good to me. The more I think about it, as Representative Kahn said, this could be a problem for really small places. And do we I guess, what problems are we solving? It seems like a solution without a problem to me. I haven't heard of great, huge problems with that.
Representative Seifert, yep. Representative Mulray, we do get complaints that on occasion that they go to a polling place for the primary election in a place where they would normally vote. They end up being told that it's in another location or they have to go find another location. They then go find that location. They vote in that polling place. And then they turn around in the general election and they go back to the polling place where they may have usually voted in a general election. Usually it's the consolidation of polling places for the primary portion of the election that occurs, and then the general election is back out into to major areas. And yes, you're right, it is in primarily a smaller population regions of the state where this occurs, and yes, we do get complaints from those voters and complaints of confusion.
Mr. Chairman, and I think at least for consideration, I like this for, you know, my city or something, but maybe there should be a certain size of the voter registered voters or something like that that is really small that we should exempt them just because of the extra large cost or something to cities. I think that should be looked at before we put this into law.
Okay. Any other questions, concerns, whatever? Okay, this will be laid over. Thank you, Representative Emmer. We have various members that have been in the audience for a long time. Is anyone really in a hurry? I'm sure all of you are, but Representative Erickson, you've been waiting enormously long.
Oh, Mr. Chair, that's fine. It's been very interesting.
Chair, move House Bill 3241 for possible inclusion. Yeah, members, let's try to move these bills along as quick as we can.
Chairman, I have an amendment to this bill.
Yeah, we got an amendment to this bill. That's why I'm a little nervous about bringing it up. So the Dean bill took way longer than it should have.
Well, can I have mine?
All right. Let's go ahead. Representative Erickson, have you explain it real briefly, and then we'll have the amendment passed out right now.
Well, Mr. Chair and committee, I think the bill is self-explanatory. What I want to remind members of is that what we put in statute can be overridden by rule. So really, this should be placed in rule. Coggin versus Davey, the court ruled that the House or Senate may pass an internal operating rule for its own procedures that is in conflict with the statute formerly enacted. So in your consideration, Mr. Chair and members, I think we have to consider the fact unless we have a rule that's parallel to this statute, there's no reason for us to even consider my bill. Article 4, Section 7 of our Minnesota Constitution gives the House and Senate the privilege and the right, actually, to enact their own rules. So with that, Mr. Chair, I welcome any decision, but I think amending this would be a little bit ridiculous, considering the fact that unless we have a rule that mirrors this this statute, if it were to become law, that's the only way we'd eliminate any questions about this procedure being able to be used.
Yeah, this bill is formally before the committee. If you look at it, it was passed to us from the GovOps committee, so it is amendable. Representative Kahn moves the E9 amendment. Representative Kahn.
Well, Madam Chairman, I don't know if Representative Erickson has been given a copy of the amendment.
Give her a copy of the amendment.
No, I don't have the amendment. Okay. Well, Madam Chairman, I was intrigued with this bill from the start, mainly because of the title of Section 1, the Prevention of Uninformed Legislators, which seems like a really good idea. And so I really thought the amendment that we drafted for this actually kind of would go much further, I think, than the bill in getting uninformed, in getting more informed legislators in terms of making sure that people... that people are fully informed before they would vote.
We have to take counts.
Yeah.
That's what the amendment
does. Representative Erickson.
Oh, I didn't see
that. Well, Mr. Chair and committee, I think this is going a bit far, to say the least. I think what we have to keep in mind is if we want the procedure that I have proposed in 3241, that this should be before the Rules Committee. Unless the Rules Committee is willing to adopt a mirrored rule, you know, we have that privilege as a legislature, and I did not realize that this was going to be probably a constitutional challenge when I accepted this House file from the Senate author. So you certainly can include it if you like. I don't want to accept the amendment because I think that makes it stupid.
Actually, I thought the amendment would be a really strong step.
Well,
because
it's
right
entertaining, I'll test for that. And certainly if Representative Seifert wants to move on.
Chairman, I think at this point I'll withdraw the amendment. But I thought if we were seriously interested in having well-informed legislators, this could get us on that route.
You know, this bill certainly, I think, conceptually would probably be better for rules rather than statutes. So I am going to move that this bill be recommended to pass, be referred to the Rules Committee, and punt it over to Representative Paulson to have him take a look at it.
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent idea.
The clerk will attach a copy of Phyllis's amendment just for to look at. Okay. Any discussion on the bill? Okay, the motion is that 3241 be recommended pass, be referred to rules. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Okay, the bill passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Next bill, Representative Westrum, 3370. The chair will move that House Bill 3370. Oh, that's on the floor right now, so we're just going to move it before the committee just so we can talk about it, Representative Westrum. This is the voter's bill of rights. Did we send it to the floor? It's already been read for a second time. This would be something we'd look at for the omnibus bill, Representative Weston. We just want to know a little bit about it, so if we put it in the omnibus, we know what we're talking about.
Okay, so would the actual bill itself still be on the general register?
Yep, it'll stay there. This okay. Just in case it gets hung up in the Senate.
All right. Both would be good.
Okay.
Both tracks. Let's see.
This would be the Voter Bill of Rights.
The Voter Bill of Rights. So, Mr. Chairman, this bill just adds a couple provisions to the Voter Bill of Rights and requires that they're posted at a polling place. And Mr. Hansen is here from the Secretary of State's office. Just to give you a quick background.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Hansen again from the Secretary of State's office. This bill does add provisions to the current Minnesota Voter Bill of Rights and organizes them under categories of access, integrity, accuracy, and to make it clear both on what the voter rights are in order to attend the or to vote, but it also what they could expect to occur at an election process and an election site as well, on the counting of the votes and on the casting of their ballots.
Very good. Any questions? I see it's had a second reading already. Representative De La Force.
Just a quick question, Mr. Chairman. I waited, Mr. Hansen, for State Government Finance to ask this. You mentioned in civil law was that no matter what, every 2 years you print enough of these for the whole state. How much does that cost?
Mr. Hansen.
I told you I was going
to
ask.
I know, Chairman Seifert, Representative De La Force. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to get back to you on that tomorrow. I don't. I forgot to ask that question. I apologize.
Tomorrow.
You're good. Any other questions on this bill? Seeing none, this bill is laid over. Representative Westrom, your last one is House Bill 3110, Voting System Criteria, Voting Machine Operations Working Group.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty either wants to join me or chime in. He's actually got a depth of knowledge on the task force that's been worked out. This basically would require paper ballots, but so that there's a record of voting, but Representative Hilty worked with several of the groups in putting together a task force that it will address some concerns that they have going forward, and that they will be able to come back with some recommendations.
Any questions?
Representative Hilty.
Representative Hilty, you wanted to put in a brief word for this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This was the product of negotiations between the counties that would have been affected by the language that we put in to accommodate them in the last session, and since the device that the language references is not available, we thought it prudent to remove that language. The counties were concerned because they thought that would limit options that they had, and what we did then is form a group, a working group, to consider options and make recommendations. I think that satisfied their concerns and actually opened up possibilities that leaving the law as it is would not have made possible. So I think everyone's happy and
wonderful.
I think this is a good bill.
Very good. I think dual track sounds good for this one. Anyone feel compelled to testify on this? Seeing none, the chair will lay over this bill. Thank you, Representative Westrom.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler, are you still here? You've been waiting an awful long time. Come on down. I'm on the committee. I can wait with my bill till the end here. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair will move consideration of 3791. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The goal of this bill is to better use the early months of the session and to establish an orderly process for the scheduling of budget decisions. Many of these ideas came out of the legislative reform process by which we sought members' ideas and had them rank it. And one clearly a clear theme of that was to start getting more bills handled and decisions handled early in the session so we have more time towards the end for the key tough decisions, but that we can clear the agenda and actually get some things done early. the bill, as it is, outlines a proposed process for the consideration of budget items. It begins with agency bills. There's actually a provision in statute right now that says that state agencies are to submit their agency bills. Those are not the budget initiatives of the governor or other policy initiatives of the governor, but basically technical fixes, updating language based on changed federal program requirements, perhaps minor adjustments in administration, or correcting technical drafting errors. And that would say that those are going to be submitted to the revisor of statutes by November 1st. We're reiterating that here because we want those to be pulled out of the budget process. Many of the hundreds of pages in those omnibus bills are things that could have gotten out of the way earlier. The subdivision 2 under Section 1 is that by January 15th of each odd-numbered year, there should be a designation of all the state programs and budget accounts in the major budget bills. Some of you know this process even better than I do, but I'm told by our fiscal staff that actually part of one of the slowdowns that happens when we start a conference committee is that our accounts don't line up between the House and Senate, and sometimes just resolving that, which conference committee has charge of which budget account, can delay further action in a budget conference committee for a number of times. This is something that we think we can get out of the way earlier. January 31st would be the deadline for committee action. So this would be the House and Senate would agree what the deadlines are for first, second, and third deadline. The State of the State address is written to recognize the governor's independent authority, but suggests that he or she would provide that advice and counsel to us within the first 10 days of the start of a session in an even-numbered year and during January in a budget year. So that early on, we get the governor's ideas out there, we can start reacting to them, and begin, you know, serious consideration of major initiatives. Subdivision 5 has the governor and his state agencies submitting their budget proposals within 10 days of the release of the governor's budget so that budget committees can start serious consideration and budget work within a reasonable time frame. Occasionally, those major budget bills have come pretty late and have meant less consideration and or delayed the process. March 15th is set forward as the price of government resolution, with April 1st being the deadline for action on individual budget resolutions in the House and Senate. So this whole first Section 1 is sort of trying to outline a very orderly process by which things will move forward in an expeditious way. It would allow about 7 weeks at the end of the session for us to get budget bills out of each the House and Senate and to come to a conference committee resolution. Section 2 is the expenses of the governor-elect. You may recall that various governors, and we've changed the occupants of the governor's office, have had to do fundraisers or beg or borrow money from other state agencies to just hire some staff and get going. We think it's appropriate that when there's a new governor, they have the opportunity to hire some staff, a couple of key commissioners, and start working on their proposals so that they can actually get a thoughtful set of policies before us. We've left on page 2, line 18, the percent of the amount appropriated to the Office of the Governor and the Lieutenant Governor blank because we felt it was really the jurisdiction of this committee to decide if we have a new governor in November, should they get 10%, 5%, what's a reasonable allocation. But the concept is that they would have a certain set of funds that they could go out and hire staff to start helping them be successful because it doesn't serve us well if nobody's on board until January, and then they delay their initiatives and their ability to assist us in understanding what they're proposing. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would be glad to respond to questions.
Questions for Representative Loeffler? Certainly somebody has a question on something. Representative Loeffler, if we don't meet these deadlines, what happens if we put them into statute?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's a very good question. And our wise counsel, Mr. Shepherd, advises me that the courts generally try and stay out of enforcing anything that's sort of our pressure to our guidelines for ourselves in statute or in rule, and that's probably wise. But that the thought is that if we put it in statute, it clearly establishes a process that at least should hopefully guide our actions over the next four or five legislative terms that legislative convention and tradition continues to be honored. It also gives direction to state agencies in terms of their expectations of when they're going to be submitting things to the revisor's office, when they're going to be the target deadlines for action. But I understand that it's an area in which we probably won't expect court cases to be resolved, but you can defer to Mr. Shepherd if you'd like that clarified.
That sound about right? Okay. Representative Blaine.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lockhart, you know, when I look at line 1.8 with what we're just talking about here, the legislature, the agencies or departments to adopt a bill to deliver that bill to the revisors by November 1st. And the one problem I have with that is the fact that one of the dates that most all the legislators that I know that look at an indicator about what we're going to do is the November and February forecast date. So if we have November 1st in line, we won't even know what the November forecast is by then.
No. Representative Lockhart.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Blaine, actually these are supposed to be the non-budget bills. What's envisioned here is the agency bills that are doing technical corrections, making, you know, changes because the federal government has said you should do X before Y, and things that don't have major implications. You'll note that on lines 110 to 112, it exempts bills necessary to implement the governor's budget proposals, other bills that are initiatives of the governor, and bills as otherwise provided in Section 3C.035. So the intent of this is just to clear out that sort of pro forma, updating the statutes, adjusting to minor changes in federal program provisions, that sort of thing. It's to clear out that kind of not very interesting but necessary legislative updates that we could take part, we could have considered. It also takes the pressure off of the revisor's office after the election, everybody starts putting in lots of ideas in for drafting, and the thought is that we would be able to get, you know, some of this stuff into drafting early and sort of make the workflow a little bit easier.
Any further discussion? Okay, the chair will lay over House Bill 3791. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Anderson, thank you for waiting so patiently. The chair will move consideration of House Bill 3390. We do have possession of this bill, members. And what we're going to do is move this for consideration for the omnibus bill, but I'd also like to dual track this to the floor, so we've got two. We got it in the omnibus and we've got it running on its own. We're a little safer that way. Okay, gentlemen?
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. The chair will move House Bill 3390 be recommended to pass. Do we know if there's a fiscal note, Ms. Roberts? To come back at zero? Oh, not yet. Okay. Ms. Roberts?
Mr. Chair, we do have a preliminary fiscal note. I'll get to pass them down the row. I believe if you look on the second page, you'll note that Dewar has done this fiscal note, and they say that because they're unable to identify members of a non-military reserve component of the uniformed service within the state workforce, they don't have the information they need to really come up with a number to quantify the fiscal impact. There will be some fiscal impact from this because it authorizes additional state employees to be eligible for this.
Okay.
Military leave. But
this is unclear. Mm-hmm. Okay. Representative Anderson, do you want to, I don't know if we should go to the floor or if we go to Ways and Means. Have you talked to Representative Knobloch at all about it? Or
Mr. Chair, I have not talked to Representative Knobloch at all to
to see one way or the other how he feels about the
You bill. Might have goes to Ways and Means for them to take a quick look at it.
Okay,
let's recommend that it pass and go to Ways and Means. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I was brought, this bill was brought to me by the gentleman that's going to testify, Mr. John Palmer, who has had individuals in close to him who work close in conjunction with him who are under state employee who mentioned to him that being involved with certain specialty type jobs performed jobs needed by the military, which military does not provide for, these individuals have been called into active duty service to help with situations of emergency for our nation and our state, and have been called into active duty service. And because of that, Mr. Chair, these members have basically been told that they have to report to duty at a certain time. They give up their particular job, which one example was teaching, the professorship. Others, another particular job was a mortician who had been making pretty good money, and all of a sudden he's needed by his country to meet the requirements of the service. So without my going too much farther, I'd like to have Mr. Palmer speak to what the concern is that he's had from friends of his who serve in our country for those special needs.
Mr. Palmer, thank you for your patience. I didn't know you were here waiting for a particular bill, or I'd have moved it up a little quicker. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
Representative, that's not a problem. It's an interesting process to watch unfold. Actually, my representative is Representative Knobloch, but knowing that he was running for Congress and having a relationship with Representative Anderson, I thought we'd have a better chance of progressing the bill by working with Representative Anderson. This is really a straightforward action. My involvement occurred as a result of my work with the inter-faculty organization, where I am a voluntary grievance officer on my campus, and I had a colleague who was activated, has been activated a number of times to respond to natural disasters or other major events. And it's been a difficult situation. The most recent activation for Katrina resulted in him being removed from state payroll and having his health insurance suspended while he was down in New Orleans. And the investigation that I did, and with the help of House Research, found some inequities. As an example, if he had been a volunteer for the Red Cross, the state would have paid the entire salary. There wouldn't have been any loss in wages. But since the individuals who are part of Homeland Security, either DVET, which is the veterinary service that's activated, DMORT, which is the mortuary service that's activated, or there is a weapons of mass destruction team, and the third is a medical response team, all we're asking with this bill is that they be treated in the same way that they're treated by the federal law relative to reemployment and leaves and what have you. The language that's been reemployment and leaves and what have you, the language that's been drafted places them in the status of being eligible for pay differential. That differential is probably going to be a small dollar amount when we get all done. With actually finding out how many state employees are on the four teams. I'd be happy to respond to questions.
Questions for members on this? So this would be, if we had a big flood in the Red River Valley or in the National Guard, you get it activated, this would pertain to that as well?
Well, the example I give is in Katrina. There were activation of the Red Cross, National Guard, and in this, the federal agency activated the Central Region DMORT team. And when they go down, to respond to the needs that the people in the disaster area have. Currently, the only activated group that does not have assurance that their pay will not be reduced are those that are working in the public health service, which is part of now Homeland Security. So it's really an equity issue to say that you could have two state employees three state employees, one a National Guard, one a volunteer with the Red Cross, and a third was involved with the federal government, DMORT, and the one with DMORT would not have pay differential. We're asking that there be equity on that. That's it.
Any questions? We'll be taking a separate vote on this. That's why I thought everybody fully informed and ready to vote. Okay, seeing no discussion, the chair will renew his motion that House Bill 3390 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Anyone in the audience that wanted to testify for or against the bill? Okay. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Okay, the bill passes. Congratulations, Representative Anderson, on that one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson has House Bill 3716, which is a separate standalone bill that the committee has possession of. And Representative Anderson will move House Bill 3716 for consideration. Is this something that, does this have a fiscal note, Ms. Roberts? Okay. Did this get handed out as well?
Yes, Mr. Chair, the yellow.
Okay, this is the yellow handout, easy to find. Okay. Representative Anderson, why don't you explain the bill and then we'll see what we should do at this one.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, the bill was brought to me by Secretary of State's office, and with me today is Jim Hansen to talk about what's happening on the federal level that's coming down to the states. And it's been suggested to the state by the federal government that the state Secretary of State's office, who handles elections, be taken into consideration what federal law has to say. And so without ado, I'll let Mr. Hansen speak regarding the federal law and regarding to elections and the ballot from overseas.
Mr. Hansen.
Representative Seifert and members, I'm Jim Hansen from the Secretary of State's office. The federal statute, the HALA statute, in Section 702 says we should designate a single state agency to provide information and registration and absentee ballots for all voters in the state. And then secondly, it recommends regarding the use of the office to accept the process and the materials that it would be the same office that provides that information. It is a recommendation from that from the United States Congress that we do the centralized ballot application receipt. There has been some concerns from raised by the counties in regards to those people that come up to their desks and asked for absentee ballots, and those processes could still be moved to the Secretary of State's office and by fax in order for us to process them quickly and still maintain that situation. Those instructions would be given to the counties after that such legislation were placed into law ahead of time. The second issue on it is frankly that we have had some anecdotal complaints from citizens in regards to the processing of absentee ballot applications from the military, where some counties have asked or have rejected ballots because they contained a Social Security number as opposed to a military voter, or I mean a military ID number. Well, in all truth and reality, the military ID number is their Social Security number. And so this is to make sure that all those ballots get processed the way, or applications get processed the way they should be processed.
Additional questions? Okay, could you please state your name for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Lucy Bosick, representing the County Auditors and Election Administrators. And first of all, Mr. Hansen did indicate that this is just a recommendation of the federal government, and we respectfully disagree with this procedure. And before I talk about that, I would like to just say first that in the last day or so, this was the first that I'd heard that there were problems with the so-called boxes of ballots that either were rejected or not counted. I don't believe that's true, and even if it is, it would have been helpful if the Secretary of State's office had actually talked to the counties and tried to resolve the issue rather than all of a sudden surfacing this in a conversation like this. Obviously, if there are problems, you can't deal with them unless they're brought to the forefront and addressed. Secondly, it seems to me that our incredible obligation here is to particularly the military folks overseas, and that we don't need to get into a bureaucratic shuffle, which is exactly what this is the counties accept these applications now and then send out the ballots. What sense does it make to have people come make an application and then we fax it to the Secretary of State's office and then they do whatever they're going to do and then send it back so that we can send out the ballots? Time is of the essence. These folks deserve to get their ballots in a timely fashion. Secondly, these applications can happen all year long, and in some counties there's a full-time person essentially that's working with these, processing them. This just doesn't make any sense. We've had no conversation with the Secretary of State's office about this process, so we really don't even know for sure how it's going to work, and we just think that our military folks in particular deserve better. Thank you.
Any questions from Ms. Bonsack, Representative Stein?
Again, Madam Chairman, what's the problem? What's not been working well?
Mr. Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, as I stated, there have been some counties that were not processing the ballots correctly or the request for ballots correctly. Those we dealt with the individual counties. We did not bring it up forward to all counties. We brought it forward to those counties that we were having difficulties with. So that's the result, is to get them so that they're processed and move forward through a standard uniform method.
But Representative Kahn, how many counties were there problems with?
Two or three.
So,
and they were some of our larger ones.
So we're going to, because of a problem with two or three counties, we're going to put something statewide that seems to put a whole additional process into it?
Madam Chairman, Representative Kahn, part of this is based on, like I said, the recommendation of the federal government that we centralize it, and so that's was the position that the office took in regards to it for simplification of that matter.
Madam Chairman, Representative Kahn, it's a recommendation, not a requirement.
That is correct.
Okay.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hansen, can you clarify for me what we're actually talking about here? When we're talking about a ballot being rejected, we're not talking about the actual ballot.
No, it was the request for the absentee ballot that was being rejected.
And so
Representative Hilty.
The request for the ballot, not ballot sent back with information on the outside.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, that's correct. It was, but then the ballot wasn't set out because they said the application was inaccurate.
Hey, did we have testimony from, okay, any other questions on the bill? Okay, we were planning on probably dual tracking this just to have some, I think, assurances that'd be dealt with somewhere. It's going to have to go to Ways and Means for review. There's usually some walking around money that they keep for these types of things, and I'm not sure that this is something that we're going to carry in the bill, actually, because of the lack of money that we've got. So I think Representative Knobloch will have to find it from some pot somewhere. Okay?
Well, Mr. Chair,
Hulte?
I think that the testimony from the counties is pretty much sums up the situation in which we're really creating a redundancy in the process. I mean, if there are problems with counties, I think they can be solved at that level. We certainly do that with other things. And to put an extra step in a process that, by and large, has been working quite well for some time just doesn't seem to make sense to me.
Okay. I apologize. I had to step out to talk to my wife for one sec. So, all right. Any other discussion on the bill? Any other people that need to testify? Okay. All right. The motion then would be that 3716 be recommended pass and go to Ways and Means. Any other discussion? Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, nay?
No.
No.
the opinion of the chair, the ayes have it. Okay, so if that bill goes off to Ways and Means.
I think the grammar is incorrect, Mr. Chair. You meant the I hazard.
Oh, the I's, yeah. But there are quiet people in the room tonight, so.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Laryngitis, thank you. Representative Anderson, is that all your bills for tonight?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your patience and your endurance.
Representative Hilty, did we do your bill already?
Yes, we did.
Okay, that one, the Loeffler bill we did. Okay, I have a bill. This, members, Truth in Advertising, this is the vehicle for the omnibus bill, I believe. Mr. Shepard, is that right? Okay. 2833 will be the bill that is used that Senator Cascaden and I have agreed jointly would be the vehicle for the omnibus bill. And it basically would be that instead of giving a summary of personnel by agency, we're making a technical change that they give us the number of FTEs in each agency program for the current biennium and projected number of full-time equivalent positions in each agency for the upcoming biennium. This is something that, as state government finance people, that we have kind of expected but really don't get. And I don't know that it's controversial at all, but we at least wanted to let people know that was the vehicle and that was the bill, and Department of Finance seems fine with it and so forth. Anybody have a question on it? So this bill will be the markup, the bill that your amendment would be. You can have an amendment to the amendment, or you can have it to this bill and mark. I don't know how we're working that, but is it going to be amendments to the amendments? Is that how we're doing it, or amendment to the actual bill? How are you drafting them?
Mr. Chair, I've been just drafting things to the delete
okay.
amendment.
Very good. Okay. Anybody have questions on 2833?
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Hilton.
This isn't really any different than what we used to do all the time, is it?
No, not really. Good question. Anyone else? Okay. That bill is laid over. And I believe we have Representative Olson as the last one. We did remove Representative Powell's health savings accounts for legislators' bill. For whatever reason, he requested that. Okay, Representative Paul asked that it not be heard tonight, so we pulled that off the agenda. Real quickly, why don't we do the minutes? Do you got that? Okay, Representative Finstead moves the minutes from the last meeting. Any questions? Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Okay, the minutes are adopted. And the last bill is Representative Olson. The chair will move House File 865. And is this moving as its own bill as well, Representative Olson?
It's not moving in Senate, so we'll try for the finance bill.
Okay, very good. The chair will move consideration of 865 for the omnibus bill. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Experience has shown that cities do not often realize that an annexation that changes city boundaries also changes precinct boundaries. This is particularly true in the case of cities with only one precinct. And the result is that the Secretary of State's office and the counties are not often always contacted, creating confusion about district lines. Current statute is unclear on that, and that's why we have this bill before us. And I have with us Mr. Jim Hansen from the Secretary of State's office to speak to the bill.
Mr. Hansen, good evening.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It's Jim Hansen from the Secretary of State's office again. This bill is to cause the timely reporting of boundary changes in the cases of annexation that occur in the state of Minnesota. Just this evening, I did have some members of the municipal clerk's people come up to me and have some concerns about the second part of this, starting in line 23. I told them that I would meet with them tomorrow and try to solicit the needed changes that would assist them, and also meet with my staff to make sure that it works in all directions. And our GIS person who handles this right now is not here tonight, and we weren't expecting this, so he wasn't here to answer those questions, and we'll resolve it tomorrow. We'd ask that you lay it over, be included in your omnibus bill with the promise that we'll try to make some changes in that language as needed.
And then we're working with the local government people trying to get this worked out, it sounds like.
That's correct.
We're good. Okay. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson.
So just identify some of the nuts and bolts of the bill. If you look on line 12 and on line 14 on page 1, you can see there's an additional notice requirement. And that's where the added communication comes in.
Okay. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Olson or Mr. Hansen, this bill, as far as I can tell, only deals with information about change. But I'm wondering, in some circumstances, and I realize the bill isn't actually dealing with that, but the question kind of occurs to me, in some circumstances, annexation that put a voter into a different precinct could put them into an entirely different, they could even put them into a different congressional district or a different legislative district or any number of changes. Is that not true?
Chairman Seifert, Representative Hilty, if a boundary changes after the precinct or after the lines have been drawn for the legislative district or the congressional district, those boundaries don't physically change as well. If they are subject to an annexation, they would still remain in those same districts. The annexation does not affect those districts and how it changes. It just changes possibly the precinct that they would be voting in, and it may cause, under the example that you gave, for a city to add a precinct to their boundaries, because obviously that individual would be voting for a different congressman than somebody else that lived in the main part of the, or the other part of the city that was pre-existing, or a different legislator. So therefore, a new precinct would have to be formed in order to accommodate that.
Any other questions on this bill? Okay, seeing none, the chair will lay the bill over. Thank you, gentlemen, for your help tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I could put in a plug for Representative Powell's bill, I'd sure appreciate it.
Yes, I know you're excited for that. I'm just not sure that he wanted to have it heard tonight, but I think we got a chance yet to bring it back up to session.
Thank you.
Members, just to let you know, tomorrow morning, in this order, we are going to try to bring up these particular initiatives. The unveiling and walkthrough of the omnibus bill will very likely be first. Representative Olson has the municipal boundary adjustments, modified task force established, money appropriated tomorrow morning. Representative Visgins has post-employment benefit account, which is fairly non-controversial. And then we have the Hackbarth Heritage Enhancement sales tax increase, motor vehicle dedications, marriage recognition, and other issues. So we'll that's the only thing that's not in there. Apparently it says the Senate file is a companion to the Osment version, but a motion was made to align this House file with the proper Senate file. Okay. Is this congruent with what the Senate's working on, Mr. Shepherd? Do you know, or not sure? Okay. I just don't want this to all be for naught that we're going through this.
They're going to merge the two House files to companion the Senate file, which was sent over today.
Okay, so the Senate file's coming over today, and they're going to try to line this up so we're not going through all of this walking over rusty razor blades for nothing tomorrow. So, members, if you have amendments, please get them ready. And we're going to try to get the Hackbarth bill finished in the morning, so we're going to have like so many minutes for opponents and so many minutes for proponents, and try to get through our other business first. I believe Representative DeLaForest is going to be arriving about 9:30, 9-ish.
No, that's what time I get up, Mr. Chief.
Okay,
no,
very good.
Yeah. I do have to bring my son to school tomorrow.
Okay.
So try to be here just as soon as before 9.
Okay. We'll get through these other items first. So, any questions on the schedule tomorrow? We will not be doing, we'll do the omnibus unveiling and walkthrough, but we're not going to do amendments or whatever. We're going to do that Wednesday. Okay? And then our deadline will be, Mr. Shipman, what's our deadline for amendments?
24 hours.
Okay. So, try to get your amendments. Well, I don't know if it's 24 hours. It's going to be kind of
tough. About 24 hours more or less.
Yeah, we'll be flexible. We're
as
not going to be
possible.
As soon as possible. I don't know how many. We got the poet laureate very likely going in, so we got some of these issues that we don't need to.
If
We don't need to belabor. But Mr. Shepard would appreciate it. We don't want to abuse him too much here. Let's try to get our stuff in. Right. That means we'd wouldn't do any amendments. So, okay, very good. Meeting adjourned.